Senator Senjum, I'm sorry. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, I move that further proceeding done to the roll call be dispensed with and that the Sergeant of Arms be requested to bring in the absent members.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Today's chaplain is Reverend Bill Davney from Valley Community Presbyterian Church in Golden Valley. And after following the prayer, please remain standing for the Pledge of Allegiance.
This is the day that God has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Let us pray. As the Senate gathers this day, O God, to seek the common welfare and greater good of this state, its communities, and its citizens, remind us all of the goodness of life which has brought us to this new moment. Remind us that we are first of all recipients of life from our parents, of love from our families, of friendship from colleagues and neighbors, all happening in a world created and filled to offer all its people their daily needs. Remind us that we are privileged to serve, that the opportunity to do worthwhile work for the greater community is an honor and a gift. As this chamber tackles the details of that work, burdensome as details can oft be, keep always in our minds the greater purpose this body serves. Give insight to grasp the greater causes and human concerns that lie behind the pieces of paper that cross these desks. Show us how all that is done here can reveal not only the better side of the human spirit, but also point to the greater guiding and creating spirit, whom we each know in our own way, the spirit which has given us this day to enjoy and for which we give thanks. Amen.
Amen. I pledge allegiance to the flag. Wonderful day. Secretary will take the roll.
Senators Bach, Benson, Bonhoff, Brown, Carlson, Chamberlain, Cohen, Dames, Daly, DeCreif, Dibble, Dietzick, Eaton, Fishbach, Gazelka, Gerlach, Gimsey, Goodwin, Hall, Han, Harrington, Hayden, Higgins, Hoffman, Howe, Ingebrigtsen, Jungbauer, Keelash, Koch, Cruz, Kubley, Langseth, Latz, Lilly, Limmer, Laurie, Magnus, Marty, McGuire, Metzen, Michelle, Miller, Nelson, Newman, Nino, Olson, Ortman, Pappas, Perry, Peterson, Reinert, Rest, Roebling, Rosen, Saxog, Senjum, Sharon, Sieben, Skoy, Spark, Stump, Thompson, Tomasoni, Torres, Ray, Vandeveer, Wieger, Wolf.
A quorum is present. Moving to the second order of business, executive and official communications. There is one printed on page one of today's Senate agenda to make note of. Moving to the third order of business, messages from the House. Secretary Ludeman will read the message.
Madam President, I have the honor to announce the passage by the House of the following House file, herewith transmitted House file number 2394, Albany Mathewitz, Chief Clerk, House of Representatives.
There is no Senate action necessary on that message. Fourth order of business, first reading of House bills. First reading. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, I move that House File 2394 be laid on the table.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Moving to the fifth order of business, reports of committee. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, I move that the committee reports printed in the agenda be accepted.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Moving to the sixth order of business, the second reading of Senate bills. They are printed on page 8 of today's Senate agenda, second reading. Seventh order of business, second reading of House bills. They are also printed on page 8 of today's Senate agenda, second reading. Moving to the eighth order of business, the introduction and first reading of Senate bills. They are printed on today's Senate bill introduction, and there is one bill to be read. The Secretary will read the bill.
Senators Rosen, Sparks, Howe, Senjum, Metzen introduce Senate file number 2080, a bill for an act relating to telecommunications. First reading.
Senate file 2080 is referred to the Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Telecommunication. In addition to that, there is one change on the Senate bill introductions on page 9. Senate file 2067 will be referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Growth. First reading. Under the ninth order of business, motions and resolutions, there are 19 motions, author's motions, that are printed on page 8 of today's Senate agenda. We will take those as one motion. All in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Continuing under motions and resolutions, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President. Are we up to Senate File 1994? I'm sorry, I have three.
841, I'm sorry, Senator.
841. Thank you, Madam President. I would move that Senate File 841 be withdrawn from the Committee on Jobs and Economic Growth and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
To that motion, Senator Ortman, this is your bill, and it's agreed upon. Yes.
Yes, Madam President.
To Senator Ortman's motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Continuing under motions and resolutions, Senator Peterson.
Madam President, I move that Senate File 1291 be withdrawn from the Committee on Education return to my office, please.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Continuing under motions and resolutions, Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam President. I move that Senate File 1619 be withdrawn from the Committee on Local Government and Elections and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
And Senator Wieger, that is your bill and all is agreed to?
Correct.
To Senator Wieger's motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Continuing under motions and resolutions, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President. I would move that Senate File 1646 be withdrawn from the Committee on Local Government and Elections and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
And Senator Ortman, that is your bill and all is agreed to.
It is. Thank you.
To Senator Ortman's motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam President. I move that Senate File 1530 on general orders be stricken and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Gimsey, I believe it's Senate File 1913.
Excuse me, Madam President. I guess I have two resolutions here.
Yes, and we'll take 1913. So Senator Gimsey moves that Senate File 1913 be withdrawn from the Committee on Taxes and re-referred to the Committee on Transportation. And that is your bill, Senator Gimsey, and all is agreed to?
It is, Madam President.
To Senator Gimsey's motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam President. I move that Senate File 1961 be withdrawn from the Committee on Local Government and Elections and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
And, Senator, that is your bill and all is agreed to.
Yes.
To Senator Eaton's motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam President. I move that Senate File 1530 on general orders be stricken and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Gimsey, that's your bill and all is agreed to. All in favor of Senator Gimsey's motion say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. There are several Senate resolutions printed on page 9 of today's Senate agenda, and those will be referred to rules. Remaining under motions and resolution, there is a motion to be read by the Secretary.
Senator Limmer moves that his name be stricken as chief author and the name of Senator Ortman be added as chief author of Senate File 1994.
To that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, members, I move that House File number 2394 be taken from the table.
To that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, I move that an urgency be declared within the meaning of Article 4, Section 19 of the Constitution of Minnesota with respect to House File 2394, and that the rules of the Senate be suspended to give House File 2394 its second and third reading and place it on final passage.
To Senator Senjum's motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. The Secretary will give House File 2394 its second reading.
House File number 2394, a bill for an act. Just a second. Third reading. Second reading.
We now have House File 2394 in front of us. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President. This bill is pretty straightforward. It's passed the House already with very close to unanimous support. There were a few folks that were concerned about it, but the bill amends our state law to require community notification prior to the provisional discharge of a sex offender from our sex offender program. This is what we want, members. We want our community residents to be aware of what's happening in their community and to be able to look out for the safety of the folks living in their community. So that's all this bill does. It authorizes notification to the community prior to this provisional discharge. And members, I do believe we have the governor's support for this.
Discussion of House File 2394. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam President. I rise not in opposition to the bill, but somewhat questioning the process, which I will admit right off the bat is better than was done in the House. I do think that there is some time before this individual is actually released, and I think that it is a really, really good discussion. And I want to applaud Senator Limmer for slowing down the process in the Senate a little bit and making sure that there was a hearing, at least in judiciary. But I do want to make note of the fact that when this first came about, the first reference that I saw to it had said that there was going to be a joint hearing between Health and Human Services, which has jurisdiction over the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and which I sit on and take that role very seriously. So it was supposed to be a joint hearing between Health and Human Services and judiciary, and it didn't turn out to be that. I was actually looking for a notice to attend that hearing. I missed it. It was just a judiciary hearing, and I was not able to hear the testimony regarding this bill. And so while the Senate did a little better than the House on process, I think that it still would have been warranted to send this bill through Health and Human Services. I don't intend to vote against this bill, but I think that it is a really important topic and some legitimate questions. So maybe would Senator Hahn yield in that? And
Senator Hahn?
Yes.
Senator Hahn, will you yield? Senator Hahn will yield. Senator Lurie.
I'm just wondering why this bill wasn't sent to Health and Human Services, wasn't requested, or maybe it was. I don't know. It didn't wind up there, and I would have really appreciated the opportunity to hear the testimony and listen to the reasons for this bill, and maybe Senator Hahn could address that.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam President, Madam Chair, sorry. And Senator Lurie, I think it's a fair question. As you know, I think as most members know, this was something that came to us rather suddenly. I got a letter from the governor announcing his support of this language and his desire to see it get done. I did have some conversation with Senator Limmer about a hearing. He felt that the proper jurisdiction was in the Judiciary Committee. I know he has worked on these issues, as have I and others in our committee, and we both felt it was important to have a hearing in a committee in our body, unlike the other body that didn't have a hearing at all. And because of the apparent desire to move quickly, we felt that having one hearing would be appropriate and was referred to the judiciary, and I did support that. But I don't think there was any intent to try to prevent discussion. My understanding is there were people from the department there to provide testimony. So our desire was to give this bill an opportunity for public exposure and public comment rather than taking it right to the floor for a vote, and that was the intent.
Further discussion on House File 2394. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam President. I don't know if I should direct this question to the new chief author of the bill or to Senator Hahn, because I know both committees cover these topics, but I'll throw the question out there and see which one of them perhaps can answer it. Does this bill apply to the approximately 600 convicted sex offenders the Department of Corrections has already released to halfway houses that are in the community? And will Senator Hahn or Senator Ortman yield to answer the question?
Senator Hahn?
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Latz, I'm looking for Senator Limmer. My understanding is that this bill would apply to people who are in the sex offender program and is limited to that, I believe. But if Senator Limmer is around, and he may be able to offer some additional comment. But if that's the case, then it would not affect anybody currently in a halfway house program because there are none there.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President and Senator Latz. This is prospective going forward only. There's no one that's been transferred under this provision before. It doesn't apply to anyone coming directly out of a correctional facility. So this is just for those being transferred out of this program, and this is the first as far as we know. So it's going forward.
Senator Latz.
Madam President, members, it sounds like for those who are already in the community that have committed even identical criminal offenses but didn't go through the civil commitment process and have been released directly by DOC to the community in halfway houses, then this bill does not cover notification in those circumstances. That's what you're telling me. A little odd to draw distinctions there. Maybe I can ask another question. Will Senator Ortman yield to an additional question?
Senator Ortman will yield. Senator Latz.
Do we provide support or services to victims other than notification to help them deal with the trauma or concerns about personal safety that may come from community placement?
Senator Ortman.
Well, Madam President, I would say I don't have the answer to that. It would be nice to be able to have a broader hearing, and I know that we've asked for further hearings about the entire comprehensive system, but I want to go back to your previous question and say the law already really distinguishes between those that are in prison and convicted in our correctional system versus those that are in hospital. These folks that are civilly committed, arguably under law, are more dangerous at this point, and that's why we want to go forward and make sure that folks that are transferred out to the community with this provision, that this is new, have this notification so the community members know what's happening. That's the answer, a better answer to your first question. When it comes to victims and the notification beyond that, I don't know what services we provide. It's a good question, and I'll try and get you an answer to that, Senator Latz.
Senator Latz.
Madam President, I think that would have been a helpful information to have in considering the bill in the deliberative process, because it's important to know how bills fit into the whole context of the statute and of the law when we're deciding whether a bill ought to be passed. Sounds like this bill does not address issues relating to victim support when there is community placement. Perhaps Senator Ortman or Senator Kinhan can address the question whether the bill deals with federal health data privacy issues at all, because these are patients that are being released into essentially treatment facilities that are community located, and whether this bill, how it dovetails with federal privacy information, how much information can actually be released in community notification that currently exists. If someone goes straight from the Department of Corrections, we don't quite have that patient component and health data component to it. So how does this bill fit in with the federal requirements or protections on data privacy?
Senator Ortman.
Madam President and Senator Latz, I believe that this is already part of the information about where these folks are going is part of a court order, so it's already public. But I think that your questions truly go beyond the scope of this bill. It's a very limited bill, and I appreciated the fact that you didn't oppose the motion to take this up and suspend the rules with an urgency. Because that's what we're talking about here, Senator Latz. We're talking about whether or not the members of the community should be notified that someone who is a sex offender is going to be transferred into their community, but that their plan is public. It's already out there, and I don't think that we need to be talking about data privacy questions here on the Senate floor because of the very limited nature of the bill in front of us.
Well, Madam President.
Senator Latz.
It seems to me that this is a question that would have been properly considered in Senator Hand's committee. And should have been evaluated no matter what's in any public court order. It's one thing to release the fact that a person is going to be residing in a particular address, but I imagine the community is going to have a lot more questions than that. And this bill doesn't, from what I can tell, doesn't seem to address how to handle that, and in fact might even erode confidence that we're going to have that our civil commitment process will meet constitutional standards when they're released because of the information that can or cannot be released when a person goes into the community. I got another question, if I may. Maybe this one's more appropriately for Senator Hand. Are halfway houses considered treatment facilities? And how does HIPAA play into that?
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam President and Senator Latz. I don't know the specific answer whether or not a halfway house falls into that definition of what a treatment facility is. I believe that the transfer is to a facility where the individual may be secured, but I'm not sure that there's an expectation that treatment would occur at that facility. I believe there are other expectations of treatment to occur beyond the residence itself.
Senator Latz. Oh, excuse me. Senator Ortman has something to add. Senator Ortman.
And Madam President, for members, this is within the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee, and Senator Latz was there, had every opportunity to ask these questions. This is not the halfway house is not a place where folks receive treatment. And so Senator Latz had actually the ability to participate and ask all the questions that he would have wanted. I hope under the circumstances members will see that this is an urgency. There is a pending transfer. I hope members will support the notification to the community members. I don't think that's this hard. I do recognize that we need to have a much more comprehensive conversation about this subject matter. And I know that Senators Han and Limmer are very devoted to having that. We are working on having those hearings. Members will be invited to participate, but this bill has a very narrow scope. I hope members will support the residents in this community who have an immediate need to know. And with respect to the other question Senator Limmer or Senator Latz asked, law enforcement professionals know how to deal with these notifications. They have all the processes. They have county attorneys to assist them, provide them the legal advice in order to make these notifications constitutional. Might be bigger, broader questions about how we treat sex offenders and about the civil commitment process and about the transfer process. But I think we can continue that after we take up this bill and pass it. I hope you will, members.
Senator Latz.
Madam President, yes, I'm on the Judiciary Committee, so I had a chance to ask some questions that I thought of in the less than 24 hours notice that was given for this hearing. But a lot of other people didn't, and frankly, for part of those 24 hours, I was at home sleeping. The fact is, normally, our Senate rules, I believe it's Rule 10, provides that, where practical, committees should give 3 days' notice of a hearing. And let me tell you, folks, the release that we're dealing with here isn't scheduled to occur for another 3 weeks. So while I understand there's a sense of urgency, the fact is it's not going to be until the second week of March is when Department of Human Services, that runs the sex offender program, is going to be releasing the individual that's the subject of this so-called urgency into the community. Certainly there would have been time to give regular 3 days notice for judiciary, and certainly there would have been time to have a hearing in Senator Hand's committee as well, so that not only I, who am by no means an expert in this category, but others who are, could have really thought about this and its implications for other areas of the statute. One other area that I don't think was even raised in committee, and by the way, I did ask some questions in committee that simply were not answered because people didn't know the answers that quickly. Is there any fiscal impact to this bill? Has fiscal staff taken a look at it, evaluated it? Have they gotten a note back saying there's no impact at all on DHS or on DOC or on local communities that will be conducting the notifications?
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President. I think members here know that sometimes due diligence as a member of the Minnesota House or Senate requires a little more than just showing up to committee. Sometimes you have to do a little research. Sometimes you have to ask good questions. Sometimes you even have to go to somebody else's committee, a committee that you don't serve on. Now, we've just declared an urgency under the Minnesota Constitution, and that's because there is a time frame here, members, and it will take some time to get the information out to the professionals, to give them a chance to do their due diligence and provide reasonable notice to members of the community and have meetings as necessary. There are some time requirements here, and I don't think we should be taking the risk that members of the community aren't aware of what might be a very significant public safety risk in their communities. That is our responsibility, members. Let's have a bigger conversation about the questions that are being raised here. They're good questions. Nobody denies that. Let's have those hearings. Let's move some of the bills that are pending to address the bigger questions. But let's not fall down on our responsibility to make sure that members who live in the communities that are affected know what they need to know to protect their families and their neighbors. Let's make sure we get that right.
Madam President,
Senator Latz.
It sounds like the chief author of the bill doesn't know the answer to my question, because I didn't hear anything in there about whether there had even been a review of the fiscal impact of this bill, let alone any response to such a review. This is one of those pass the bill now, ask questions later process. We, as members of the Senate, answerable to our constituents, is that the approach that we want to take? Certainly, there's not 3 or 4 more days to be able to actually get answers to some of these questions before we take a vote on whether to do this. I think it's alarmist to suggest that there is actually any immediate risk to the community by taking another several days to consider these questions. They weren't answerable by the chief author in committee or by some of the experts in committee. They weren't even asked by any members of the Health and Human Services Committee that weren't notified that they had a committee hearing where this topic was even going to be considered. If we are about a deliberative process, members, this is rushed. This is rushed, and although, yes, we have declared an urgency, I think it's rushed for no obvious reason. No public member is going to be in any threat here, and the public should know there are a lot of people out in the community already in facilities just like this who've committed the same offenses for which there is no community notification, and we haven't fully evaluated that whole policy either. So, members, I think the Senate ought to be nervous a bit about this particular process. Oh, no, we had about an hour and a half in committee. The House didn't even have a hearing on this, members. I mean, what kind of process is this?
Senator Ortman.
Madam President, this just moves up the timing of the notification to the point of transfer. We already do this. And let me just say, we're talking about one known sex offender. We're talking about one notification in one community. I think we can manage that, and we can go back and look at this process. But I encourage anyone that disagrees with this to just simply vote no. I'd like to believe we have the support of the members of this community on behalf of the residents and the families. There was only one no vote in the House. I'm passing around Governor Dayton's letter of support. I hope you'll vote yes. Stop standing in the way here. I'm sure the governor has access to whatever funds are necessary to pay for a notification. As I've said, and I know Senator Limmer has, Senator Han has, they are committed to having hearings on the broader issues, provide additional information before a second notification has to happen here. But let's get this information out to the people who need to know.
Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam President. And we are under an urgency, and we are going to vote on this bill. And I think it's going to meet with broad bipartisan support when we push our red or our green buttons. In fact, I plan on pushing the green button. But I do think that we did have a little bit of time to spend a little bit more of our resources thinking about whether this is exactly the right approach or not. There are some legitimate questions. I think that, you know, when the question was posed, was this: are these treatment facilities, are group homes treatment facilities? The idea of sex offender treatment became what the question was about. Our halfway houses are really community-based institutions providing health services. Maybe not sex offender treatment, but they are, I believe that they are providing health services, which would bring them under HIPAA regulations, and that's kind of the broader point. So whether we're treating, giving sex offender treatment or not within this facility isn't the point. The point is, are they under HIPAA? And I don't think that we've gotten a good answer to that question. I mean, I just really think that we had another day. I mean, truthfully, the bills that we've been addressing in Health and Human Services could easily have been set aside for a day to give us time to deal with this very pressing and time-sensitive matter, and we should have done that on behalf of the people of Minnesota. I think there's also the potential of some local government costs. So again, I don't anticipate voting against this bill. I know that the governor is in support of it as well, but I do hope that we pay attention to good process and return to this issue and have a more thorough discussion about there might be additional ways to make sure that we provide for the public safety that we're looking for, but also move forward with the Minnesota Sex Offender Program in a manner that allows us to get people out the back end of this. This is something that has perplexed us for a very long time, and when we address items regarding the Minnesota Sex Offender Program based on reaction to things that happen in the community, this is the exact procedure that led us to some very troublesome statistics in our Minnesota sex offender program. We have more sex offenders in Minnesota than any other, per capita, than any other state in the nation. And we're about the only, I think we are the only one who has never successfully released one. And these issues need to be thought about and deliberated in a really thoughtful manner, and that is what we have our committee structure set up to do. And we owe it to the people of Minnesota to fulfill that duty. So I do plan to vote green. I don't intend to stand in the way any longer, but these are legitimate questions, and I hope that we have the respect for the committee process and the people of Minnesota to do our job here in St. Paul.
Further discussion, Senator Sharon.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to address the body on this issue. I also intend to vote for this, but I need to speak coming from a community that I represent in St. Peter, Minnesota, that has a community partnership with the Sex Offenders Program that is in my region. And persons that we're speaking about here and others have as a part of their treatment program as they move through the phases a community-based transitional reentry process. So community, like St. Peter, partners with the treatment program for sex offenders, and these persons are in the community all the time, going to the library, going to the stores to purchase things. As a part of their treatment program, they're learning to move and to adapt to community living, beginning to understand some of what those pressures will place upon them, and learning how to manage those so that they don't retreat into old behavioral patterns. So my concern about the Senate, and I think the Senate has a higher obligation, is to not participate in the misinformation that gets communicated and creates anxiety and panic in the public. What this bill does that I intend to vote for, because the public is highly anxious about not having the information they think they need to be safe, so I will vote for it in concern to that. But the problem is we're not giving them enough information as a result of this bill in order to make a determination about the level of risk. And it's because of what information is protected as health information. That's the information, along with the fact that the person is going to be released, that helps the public understand the risk level and understands what it is that has happened for the person. What transitional activities and communities have happened before they've been placed in the new community. So when we only give partial information on a subject that is highly volatile and highly anxiety producing to the public, that's incomplete, then we're participating in creating a panicky situation rather than creating a solid and reasonable community response to the transitional programs from the sex offenders. So I think the Senate as a body has to rise above some of what is community anxiety or panic and address these issues in a more comprehensive way.
Further discussion on 2394. Seeing none, the Secretary. Senator Ortman, can we give a third reading? And then if you want to make final comments, Secretary will give House File 2394 third reading.
House File Number 2394, a bill for an act relating to public safety requiring community notification when a person is released from the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Third reading.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President. I hope we're getting close to a final vote on this. I hope members will support this bill. I understand that there are questions from members here about this program, but I just want to point out for members that have not been engaged in this debate so far, there are only four bills that have been introduced in this legislative session that relate to Chapter 253B, the civil commitment process. The chief authors would be Senator Hahn, Senator Limmer, Senator Newman, and me. Now, I know you have questions. They're very good questions. I hope we'll continue to have this conversation. Your thoughts, your questions, your concerns are very welcome. We will continue to talk about this subject in our committees, and we'll ask for your help.
Secretary will take the roll on House File 2394. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, The secretary will close the roll. There being 61 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Senator Ortman.
Madam President, I would move that Senate File 1994 on general orders be stricken and laid on the table.
To that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, pursuant to Rule 26, I designate the House File 1467, which is number 2 on your general orders, be made a special order for immediate consideration.
Senator Senjum has designated House File 1467 a special order. Senator Hoffman.
Madam President, before she
starts the bill,
I'd just like to note for the body that the intent here is to take this till 1 o'clock. If it goes that long, at 1 o'clock we'll recess and come back at 4:30 if the bill is not completed.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, House File 1467, otherwise titled the Defense of Dwelling and Person Act of 2012, has a couple of proponents that will change Minnesota's law. Article 2 addresses weapon seizure during states of emergency. This was prompted from the Katrina disaster when law enforcement went in and just confiscated law-abiding citizens' weapons. And in a time of chaos, we know that leaving law-abiding citizens undefended doesn't lead to very safe outcomes for them. So we are acting a little proactively here to get that changed for Minnesota. Article number 3 removes the duty to retreat that's currently in our Castle Doctrine law. Right now in Minnesota, if you are not in your home, you have a duty to retreat. If you're someplace lawfully, there are a great many of us that believe that you should be able to be there lawfully and that the onus should be on the criminal and not on the victim to be held responsible for their violent actions against another person. It also creates a presumption of reasonableness that protects the victim if they defend themselves. It allows victims to use force against violent felons, and it also protects victims from facing prosecution of lawsuits for defending themselves. And then the last article recognizes other states' permit to carry or licenses from other states. So I would ask members' support of this bill, and I will stand for questions.
Further discussion of House File 1467. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam President.
President.
Senator Hoffman, for what purpose do you rise?
Oh, before Senator Goodwin, I do have an amendment that maybe could put the bill in the order if Senator Goodwin would yield.
Would that be acceptable, Senator Goodwin?
Certainly.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. I have the A9 amendment.
Secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Hoffman moves to amend House File Number 1467, the unofficial engrossment as follows. Page 6 after line 4, insert. This is the A9 amendment.
To the amendment, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. At the request of the Sheriff's Association, we worked with them over the last week, and we changed some language in the bill to make the bill a little bit more so they could have a little bit more appetite for it and have a little bit more assurance that they'd be protected. And so what we did was we added the term after knows or has reason to know that the person against whom the defensive action is taken is being taken as a licensed police officer from this state, another state, the United States. And so we feel like this affords our law enforcement a little bit more protection in the event that they're doing a no-knock warrant or even just any warrant. So I ask members' support of the amendment.
Further discussion to the A9 amendment. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair and members, I was surprised to hear Senator Hoffman say that the Sheriff's Association is behind this amendment, because I've been assured by the representative from the Sheriff's Association that they had one assistant, the Sheriff's Association, that there was one assistant county attorney that had forwarded the amendment to you, but had not done so with the authorization of the Sheriff's Association that he also gives some advice to. And the Sheriff's Association, as I understand it, still stands with the Chiefs Association and with the Police and Peace Officers Association and the County Attorneys Association in opposing the underlying bill, with or without this amendment. So I'm surprised to hear it represented on the floor that the Sheriff's Association, as an organization, has taken a position in support of this amendment. Could I get some elaboration by the chief author on that?
Just as a gentle reminder, I know this is going to most likely be a long debate, but we need to address the comments to the president, and we need to face the president so that this doesn't get personal. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. I don't believe I said the Sheriff's Association supported the amendment. I said that the suggested language came through them. That was my understanding, as the person in question represents them. And that's where the language, we looked at this as a compromise for what they were asking. I don't believe I said the Sheriff's Association supported the amendment. I said it came through their representative.
Further discussion to the A9 amendment. Seeing none, Senator Hoffman renews her motion to adopt the A9. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Harrington.
Madam President, I rise in opposition to this bill.
Senator Harrington, we are on the A9 amendment. Is it to the amendment?
I withdraw. Thank you.
Further discussion on the A9 amendment. Seeing none, Senator Hoffman renews her motion to the A9 amendment be adopted. All in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion or the amendment is adopted. Further discussion to the bill, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam President. And would Senator Hoffman yield to a question?
Senator Hoffman will yield. Senator Goodwin.
Okay, I'd like to Senator Hoffman to tell us that. If this passes, what are the list of places where you can't use deadly force if you believe that your life is being threatened? What are the places in Minnesota where you'd be prohibited?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. This bill does not change our current law. This is about defending yourself if you are someplace lawfully. So anything that's in current law, if there's a prohibition in current law, this wouldn't supersede that. If you are someplace where you can lawfully be and you are threatened with a violent act, you should be able to defend yourself. And so that's what this bill addresses.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. So if you're lawfully at a school or a church or somewhere like that, then that would be a place that you could use this provision. Is that correct, Senator Hoffman? Would you yield, please?
Senator Goodwin. Or excuse me, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. As I said before, any place that's already prohibited in law to have a gun, you would not be able to use it. But let me make the point here that this bill isn't about guns. This is about deadly force. And as we saw in Blue Earth a few days ago, the tragedy in Blue Earth, there was no gun used in that tragedy. It was a blunt object. Anything can be used to exert pain or death on somebody. It could be a baseball bat, it could be a fist, and it could be a knife. So any place that you are lawfully present, you should have the ability to defend yourself, whether it's a fist or a baseball bat. You should be able to react with equal or greater force if you feel threatened of grave, great, or substantial bodily harm.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. So what we're saying here basically is that you could be on a park bench or on a bicycle or on your sidewalk or on somebody else's sidewalk or in somebody else's house, in a hotel room or motel room. I can think of a variety of places where you could be. You could be in a drug house and you felt threatened by somebody else that was coming in the drug house. I can't think of hardly any places that you couldn't use these provisions, and so it's That makes it, I think, the most broad-based language that we have in the United States. I did a lot of research on this bill, and my interns did a lot of research, and I got a lot of information from the legislative library on what all the other states do. So what we've got here, in conjunction with current law that allows violent felons to carry guns again by simply approaching any court, any judge, and asking them for their gun rights back as soon as they are let out of prison and off parole. What we have here is the absolute most aggressive bill for gun rights in the United States. So I don't know that we want to go down that path exactly, but I want to give you a little information here about some of the other states and what they do about giving felons back their gun rights. In Alabama, no violent felons get gun rights back. Parole board for any other rights. In Arizona, firearms rights regained only through pardon by governor. Others are automatically restored. Arkansas, gubernatorial pardon only. California, even with pardon, gun rights not restored if crime involved dangerous weapon. By governor pardon in Colorado, by governor pardon only, governor pardon only and not for 10 years. What happened here in the Minnesota legislature in 2002 is that we had a terrible crime committed in our community where several police officers got shot. It was committed by a man who had several years before killed his wife and a person that was driving her home from work, shot them both in the head and killed them. So he got his gun rights back, and the police stopped him one time, and he had 19 weapons in the backs of his car, but they couldn't do anything to him because he has gun rights back. Well, within a week or two of that incident, he shot at a police officer who was walking home from the station in his in his civilian clothes, and he hit him, and he had two rifles, one in each hand, and he was shooting like crazy. The police officer went up to a woman's house, 86-year-old woman, and begged her to get in, and once he got in, he got down on the floor, and the man shot through the 86-year-old woman's house. His gun rights were restored. We had to restore his gun rights. Federal law says you can't get your gun rights restored without a presidential pardon, except for if you go through the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms and you give good reason. We have circumstances here, and you can read the article that I handed out in the New York Times. That was November 13th, and they talk about the gun rights, how easy it is to regain gun rights in Minnesota, and that's really an embarrassing article for Minnesota. It talks about circumstances that have happened since some of those gun rights have been given back, supposedly for goose hunting or some other thing. But in the question and answer thing that's in there from the New York Times a couple of days following this article, they also named Minnesota as the top state for violent felons getting their guns back. So what happened in 2002 is, as a result of that, we tried to tighten up the law a little bit because Minnesota had allowed you to get your guns back in 10 years. And we wanted to tighten that up a little bit. Well, what happened is the NRA came along and gun advocates, and they managed to loosen it instead. So what we are ending up with is the loosest law in the nation for getting your guns back. Now we're going to say not only can you get your guns back just by getting a favorable judge to allow you to do that, but we're saying now you can shoot anywhere, a park bench, a city bus, a snowmobile. You can shoot anywhere if you believe you are threatened. If you believe you are threatened, that in itself is a very loose standard. So, folks, I really think you need to read some of these articles and take a look at what we're doing here. You know, when we're looser than Texas and Florida and Colorado and Indiana and all those states in our gun laws, that says a lot about what we're doing here. This might be called the Castle Doctrine, but in every state we found the Castle Doctrine was defined differently. Sometimes it's only defined as protecting your own home. Sometimes it's defined as protecting your yard and your home and your place of business. This is a complete new expansion of the term Castle Doctrine. And so I would really encourage you to look at some of this information. And it is important what other states are doing. It's very important that we are now going to allow people from those states to come in here and have the same rights to use a gun anywhere. I think it's a really, really major change in policy here in the state of Minnesota, and I hope we can kill this bill, or I hope the governor can veto it.
Further discussion? Senator Harrington, do you want to speak now, and then we'll get to McGuire, Senator McGuire. Senator Harrington, whenever.
Madam President, I rise in opposition to this bill, and thank you for my correction earlier. So I'm a little flustered. I just came back from surgery with my significant other, so I rushed here because I really thought this was such an important piece of legislation that I felt compelled to make it here. There are other places I think I probably should be, but I don't think there is any piece of legislation that's going to come before us that has more ominous implications for the peace and well-being of Minnesotans. The changes bill are absolutely sweeping and absolutely unnecessary. I would challenge anyone in this body. There's been an open challenge offered already to those in the public to give me one case where a person who has been defending themselves in the state of Minnesota has been prosecuted, charged, or convicted. They can't do it because it doesn't exist. It just simply doesn't exist. This is a solution, once again, in search of a problem that just simply doesn't exist. I would ask the body and the author whether they believe that the Minnesota County Attorneys Association has the public's best interest at heart. They are the individuals duly elected in the 87 counties of the state to make sure that justice is served, and that they are, as sworn officers of the court, absolutely have a commitment to the public safety and to justice. The county attorneys, as a body, oppose this bill. I'm going to say that again. The County Attorneys Association, as a body, oppose this bill. This is not simply the county attorneys in the metro area, but these are the county attorneys from across the state of Minnesota. They see this as an unnecessary bill. They see this as a bill that will make their job more difficult to bring justice to the victims and to the innocent. I would ask if the Minnesota Chiefs of Police, the chiefs large and small, from the big departments like Minneapolis and St. Paul to the small departments all across this fine state of ours, individuals who, like me, took an oath, most of them back in our youth, to serve and protect the public. It's an oath we didn't take lightly. It's an oath that every day, and it's an unusual oath, frankly, that most other people, I don't think, other than soldiers, really can ever really grasp. We get up every morning when we're cops, we put on a bulletproof vest, we strap a gun on our hip, and we go out to interpose ourselves, our lives, our hopes, and our dreams for the protection of everyone else. We don't ask anybody else to do this. This is a charge that we take on willingly and voluntarily, but we take it very, very seriously that our mission is to protect those under our charge, those who live in our jurisdiction, those who are visiting our jurisdiction. We take this so seriously that we are willing to give up our lives for the protection of others. The chiefs of police, as a body, the state of Minnesota, big chiefs and little chiefs, and all the chiefs in between, as a body, that group has said, this is a bad law. This is a bad bill. This will not make people safer. This will not protect the public. And not only that, they have said that this will, in fact, make their jobs much more difficult And I can honestly tell you, with just a few occasions within my own experience, this will make their jobs much, much more dangerous. The people that we pay to protect us, is it really our intention as a body here to make their job both more dangerous and more difficult? The sheriff's departments. We've had mentioned that an individual from one sheriff's department or who consults with the sheriff's department has brought some legislation that he thinks makes this a more palatable bill. Well, I can tell you from one case in Minneapolis where even with that additional language, it doesn't make this bill any better. Dave Mack, a Minneapolis cop, walked up on a doorway trying to serve a search warrant. Dave was in plain clothes. He was an investigator. He had his badge around his neck, as I recall. And upon his entry to the house, he was shot by, in fact, the person they were trying to serve the warrant on. They had announced themselves, but he was in plain clothes. Should the shooter have reasonably known that Dave was a cop? I think he probably should have reasonably judged that. But the courts ruled, based on the already existing Castle Doctrine, that he was not guilty. That he was defending his castle, and he was in fact not charged or convicted. Dave Mack died a few years ago after having retired with the injuries suffered in that particularly fatal encounter. Should the bad guy have known that Dave was a cop? I would argue yes. The Castle Doctrine protected that individual from prosecution even then. The Sheriff's Department, once again, unique group, 87 counties, duly elected, all with their own election certificates, have as a body said, this is bad law. This isn't just the metro sheriffs. This is the rural and the greater Minnesota sheriffs also. We all live in their jurisdictions. And once again, they have that unique perspective of individuals who strap on a gun and a badge and a vest and every day go out to protect us all. And they see this as bad law. I remind the body that there have been no cases, not one case, of someone being charged when they were defending themselves under the current law we have in Minnesota. This bill makes it sound like home invasions are an everyday occurrence, when in fact they are extremely rare. And on those rare occasions when they do happen, our current law allows the homeowner to take appropriate and reasonable action to defend themselves. I typically try and leave what is to Caesar and leave moral arguments aside, because I really think that we should have that wonderful separation of church and state. But I think it is important for us to really think about what this law says, what moral imperative that it pronounces. It pronounces that killing people, a cleaned-up version, you can say deadly force, we can see justifiable taking of a life, we can clean this up, but what we're ultimately talking about is killing people shouldn't be a last resort. That, in fact, if you think you're in jeopardy, whether there's any reasonable point to believing that or not, that you should be able to act on that belief, and that based on that belief and that belief alone, you should be able to take someone else's life. I caution that this bill will have dire consequences, and I normally am not one who I think says doom and gloom, but we have enough cases of accidental shootings now. And I want you to think how we're going to feel if we validate this if we pronounce that this is, in fact, good law, that this is good practice, that this is for the common good, that when the teenager, your teenager, your son or daughter, comes home late at night under stealth, I came home late at night, and usually it was under stealth because I knew that my parents were not going to be happy with me if I came home late at night. I would bet that there's several other individuals in this room who may have, in fact, snuck back into the house after a late night outing. Do we want to say it's okay to the parents that hearing that creak coming up the back steps, that tap at the back window as they sneak back into the house, that the first option that you should think about is grabbing your pistol and firing into the dark? I'd say no to that. I would say that when you're stranded on the side of the road and it's dark and it's stormy and it's scary out, and somebody pulls up behind you and gets out of the car and walks up to your window, that we take a moment to find out if it isn't the highway helper before we open fire through that window because we were afraid sitting in our car. Deadly force and the use of firearms should always be the last resort. For 35 years, I worked as a St. Paul cop, and I can tell you that every day that we went out there, every day of training, every day, we emphasized the fact that we should use the minimum amount of force to overcome resistance or to end the threat. It was always the minimum amount of force to be used. This bill validates an automatic capital judgment for things that we don't think are capital in a state where capital punishment has long been abolished. This is bad moral law as much as is bad civil law. The right in this bill actually confers new rights to people I don't think we necessarily would want to have those rights. Most of you don't spend any time kicking indoors to crack houses or meth labs or the Hell's Angels Clubhouse or other places of that kind. But I can tell you, in the words of Chief Gordon Ramsey, the chief up in Duluth, that he has seen officers lost and killed under just those circumstances. Officers who walked up to a door where the bad guy thought that there were people coming to rip his dope off, and who fired through the door, killing one officer and mortally wounding the other. That's what this bill brings us. It brings us further chance. Now, this was two cops that were knocking on the door. It could just as easily have been the bellman. It could just as easily have been a neighbor calling to say, could you quiet it down? And according to this law, because he thought he was in jeopardy, because he thought he was under threat, that use of force would be justified and immune, he would be immune from prosecution. Is that really what we want here in Minnesota? To make the bad guys immune from prosecution when they shoot each other or when they shoot a cop or a neighbor or your kid? My last general point is about the permitting piece in here. This bill allows anyone who's permitted to have a handgun in any state of the union to have that right recognized here in Minnesota. Now, I moved here from another state to become a cop. When that happens in the state of Minnesota, we don't just accept that another state's cops are as good as St. Paul's Finest or the Minnesota State Patrol. We require them to prove that they have comparable testing, comparable experience, and comparable training. We have reciprocity tests. We require years of experience. And that's for our police officers, who we know from backgrounds have in fact been sworn to serve and protect in other jurisdictions, And yet, here in the state of Minnesota, we don't allow just any cop to walk in and put on our shield and jump in our squad car and drive away. We require a proof that they are, in fact, competent to exercise what is one of the most tremendous authorities and responsibilities we can give to any individual. I would ask, does it make sense to do less? And I would argue no. The state of Alaska, for example, if you're over 18 and alive and well, you can basically get a gun. Go down south. The rules are that you need to be of good character, which basically means somebody has to write you a note for you to get a permit to carry. There is no requirement for them to know the laws. There is no requirement for them to have any safe handling. There is no requirements whatsoever in so many states of the union. And yet we're going to say, come to Minnesota. Whatever was good enough for Bama is good enough for here. Is that really what we want? Is that really the level of confidence you want to have when you walk into a place that you know allows people that are permitted to carry? Do you really want to have no standards whatsoever? And that's what this bill allows for. I stand in opposition to this bill, as do my brothers, chiefs of police, the Minnesota sheriffs, and the Minnesota county attorneys, and the rank and file officers who every day strap it on and go out there to serve and protect, the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. All across the state of Minnesota, those individuals who have sworn to serve and protect you are standing up and saying to you in a loud and clear voice, please vote no. You are making our lives more dangerous. You're making the public's lives more dangerous. And however well-intentioned this bill may have been, it does absolutely nothing to make us safer.
I do have Senator McGuire next, but Senator Bonhoff indicated that it might be to that point. Is that Senator Bonhoff?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, in that I was following Senator Harrington and was going to address, in fact, the nature of the comment Senator Harrington made. You know, it is a privilege to actually listen to Senator Harrington speak about these issues because he speaks about them from a different place than I address them. You know, I'm a layperson. Yeah, I'm elected to be a state senator, but I have no background in this area. Senator Harrington not only was the St. Paul cop, as he spoke about, but a very highly respected St. Paul police chief. And so to have that kind of experience and expertise in our body is something that I, for one, take great pride in and look to him for his expertise and his experience in this matter. I grew up in a family where the men hunted, and I loved to go with my father and my brothers hunting whenever I could. And just this past holiday season, I had my dad bring me to the gun shop in Glen Lake so I could pick out a new gun for my son to go hunting. And he, you know, was just shocked that that's what his mom gave him. You know, he couldn't have been happier. So this isn't about a value on guns, good, bad. This is about experts and expertise, and I have an outstanding relationship with the police chiefs in the communities that I represent. Police Chief Mark Riquette in Minnetonka, Police Chief Mike Goldstein in Plymouth. And so when there are matters before the body that I don't know much about, I know it's important to go to the experts. I've been, deluged with communications from citizens on both sides of this issue, very emotionally charged for some reason or another, I think because it goes to that fundamental right in the Constitution, the right to bear arms. And so somehow citizens have perceived this issue like it's an attack one way or another on our right to bear arms. And in fact, that's just not the case. That is not what this is about, and no one in this chamber is disputing that. So I listen to the concerns of my citizens, and I listen to my own kind of thoughts one way or another on it, But in the end, I go to the experts and I ask their opinions and I take the time to meet with them and hear their concerns. And we talk a lot in this body about the importance of data-driven decision-making and about using best practices as we weigh matters. And so it's a little bit hard for me to understand, given we say that is something we so greatly value, that when our experts, like Senator Harrington and the Minnesota police chiefs and the county attorneys, unanimously tell us this is not a direction that we ought to be going and that would in fact cause the people who are entrusted to protect us to be perhaps in harm's way, it is quite surprising to me that we as a body would actually not only engage in debate in this, you know, manner, but that most likely today it will pass. So I apologize on behalf of the Minnesota Senate to those experts if, in fact, we don't listen to them, because then I think we are doing them a grave disservice. So I personally, on the record, want to thank those who represent us, those people who put their lives in harm's way to do that, and let them know that I, for one, as a Minnesota State Senator, have great respect for their service, their opinions, and their expertise. Thank you.
Senator Hoffman, was this specifically to the previous comments, or because I do have a list, so I'm.
It was Hoffman. A comment to Senator Harrington, Madam President.
Go ahead, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. I just want to clarify a couple things that Senator Harrington said. First of all, the amendment that we put on the bill should offer some assurance that we are trying to protect our law enforcement. And the other thing that I want to make sure that everybody in this body understands is that we aren't changing current law. We're not changing the current law that the police protections have been afforded. And so if we are going to tell the citizens of Minnesota that the cops are the only people that can carry guns, what happens to our rights to defend ourselves? Because although the cops have taken a pledge to protect us, they can't be everywhere at once. I live in the country, and my sheriff's office is 45 miles away, and that is, if he could get in the car and be at my house in 45 minutes, he'd be 45 minutes too late. And so I appreciate everything that the law enforcement does for our state. There's a couple of other things that Senator Harrington, and I can't remember them all, obviously, but 21 other states already allow people to protect themselves in special places. And Senator Harrington is actually correct when he says that home invasions are rare. That is actually true. About 17% of all violent crime in homes, as far as home invasions, it's about 17% of those kind of robberies. 83% of robberies and violent crimes occur outside the home, and that is from the FBI crime statistics. And so while I appreciate that we have Castle Doctrine in the state, that's a great step towards our Second Amendment rights, but the most crime to the body, to the person, occurs outside of the home. So I just wanted to clarify those remarks of Senator Harrington's.
I'm sorry? Senator Harrington.
Madam President, I appreciate the numbers that were tossed out about home invasion and about robbery, but that's really not what this is about. This is about making any felony committed in a house the equivalent of a robbery. The vast majority of felonies committed in the houses are, in fact, property crimes, not crimes of violence, not designed or geared to inflict any injury on the homeowner. They are mostly property crimes. And this would allow us to take a property crime and make it into a capital offense. Felony theft. Someone takes your purse, but they reach into your house to do it with no threat to you whatsoever. Suddenly now, the justifiable use of force in taking a life would be okay. I appreciate Senator Hoffman's attempt to give me some comfort in terms of the language about no or shouldn't reasonably know. But I can tell you that the standard of proof that she is offering in this bill, as it takes it from an objective basis the reasonable standard. What would a reasonable person under the same circumstances come to believe? And making it simply what is in the mind of the shooter doesn't give me any comfort, because it really does open the door completely to any threat, any perceived threat, any delusional thought there might be a threat, suddenly becomes reasonable under this doctrine.
Next on the list, I have Senator McGuire and Senator Cruz. I will put you on.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam President. I rise also in opposition to House File 1467, known by those who have who understand the implications of the bill, known as the Shoot First Bill. And we've been seeing a lot in this body, in this chamber. We've been seeing a lot of legislation that's proposed to solve problems that don't exist. So I would want, I would ask Senator Hoffman to yield. I've asked Senator Hoffman to yield, Mr. President.
Senator Hoffman will yield.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. So could you please identify for me even one instance, two would be good, of cases where our current law does not protect a person in their homes? Give me any example of where we need this bill, any time when our current law has not been able to satisfy what our criminal justice system requires for the safety of our citizens. Can you please identify any cases?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. President. As I stated in my opening remarks, our current law does protect us in our home, but current law does not protect us when we are out in lawful places around our communities, in our yards, in our outbuildings, on our boats, whatever it is we choose to do when we're doing it lawfully. Current law has duty to retreat, which actually puts the onus on the victim and not the criminal. And our job here in the Minnesota State Senate is to protect the innocent victims and not the criminals. And so this law will turn the onus back to the criminal and off the victims. And that's the difference. We have castle doctrine. We can defend ourselves in our home. We are talking about when we're legally anywhere that we are acting lawfully.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. President. So Senator Hoffman, can you please give me one example of where we need this? I still haven't heard where where we have a situation where this has actually been needed.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. President. Actually, if I distributed a newspaper article from the Des Moines Register, and here is a man who defended himself, and he lost his life. For 122 days, he was in jail. He lost his home, he lost his job, he lost his belongings. And at the end of the day, the jury found him not guilty. And in fact, the jury was quoted as saying, if I can find it here, that this should have been an easy thing for the people to have determined, and for this gentleman to have lost everything he has, one case is too many cases. Again, we have a Second Amendment right in this country to defend ourselves. And this bill will make sure that we are able to do that in all situations and not have to have those moments of pause. Should I run away or should I defend myself? I am not an agile young woman like I used to be. I live in the country, and if a 25-year-old kid comes in my yard and decides he's going to perpetrate some violence on me, whether that be rape or assault, I'm not going to be able to outrun him. And I don't want to have that second thought, oh, gee, should I run away or can I defend myself? And as I said earlier, this bill isn't about guns. This is about the use of deadly force. And anything that you can pick up can be used. We burn wood at our house. I could pick up a log, and that would be deadly force, a baseball bat, a knife. So there are instances where people have to have that second thought. Our duty in the Minnesota State Senate in government is to protect people's rights, especially their constitutional rights, and that's what this bill does.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. President. So, Senator Hoffman, I still haven't heard any examples in Minnesota of a time when we actually need this bill. So I guess there's no examples of it that our current law is actually is protecting the citizens of the state of Minnesota, because I have asked three times for examples and I have not yet gotten one, but I know that you keep repeating that this is the use of deadly force with any weapon. So this is very expansive. This is a very expansive bill. And so I have another question, if Senator Hoffman would yield for another question, Mr. President.
Senator Hoffman will yield.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman, so you expand the definition of dwelling. You expand it in Article 3, Section 1. And so if you could please explain to me the definition and the extent of a building's or conveyance's curtilage.
Senator Hoffman.
Any place that's outside your home, this bill will protect you. So if you are standing on your front step and somebody comes at you with a fist, a knife, a bat, a gun, whatever, you have the right to defend yourself. And in my gun training classes, I learned that if somebody with a knife is 21 feet away from you, you will hardly have time, if you have a gun, to defend yourself. He will have been on top of you and stabbed you. So we are trying to afford citizens the right to defend themselves. And as to your earlier question or statement, I passed around another article, and it says arrests made in Blue Earth home invasion. These people's homes were invaded, and the man was bludgeoned to death. And I mentioned that earlier. These things are occurring, and we need to afford citizens the most protection that we can. These are the law-abiding citizens. We need to err on their side and not on the side of the criminals.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'll read those examples more carefully, Senator Hoffman, but my sense is that our current law would indeed be covering those. But in response to your response on that, the buildings or conveyances curtilage includes anything outside a home. So if it's 2 blocks outside a home, if it's 2 miles outside of home, are you able to use deadly force if you're in fear of any danger? I mean, are you just saying that anywhere you are in the state of Minnesota, because it would be somewhere outside of your home, because we're in the state of Minnesota, that you could defend yourself with deadly force without asking questions? Is that what I understand your response to be?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator McGuire, I think I've stated that over and over again, that this bill protects you where you are lawfully present. And if you are lawfully present and somebody tries to commit an unlawful act of violence against you, you would be able to defend yourself under the provisions in this bill. Again, we need to err on the side of the victim and not the criminal.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. President. So if you're sitting on a park bench and someone comes walking by like they would in a park, and you suddenly fear them for no reason, but you do fear them, and you have a gun, you can shoot them, and you can say, well, they looked at me, and I was afraid, and I shot them. Is that okay?
Are you asking Senator Hoffman to yield?
Sorry, Mr. President, yes. Would Senator Hoffman yield for another question?
Senator Hoffman will yield.
Thank you, Mr. President. I've answered that question, and you can go on and on and on with all kinds of little examples, but the bill states that if you are any place lawfully present, you can defend yourself. And I understand Senator McGuire's want to have every specific of every incident of every place that anybody could ever be in their entire lives, but those kind of situations, we could be here till midnight talking about. I've answered the question. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. President. So I'm to understand that, yes, the answer is yes. You're sitting on a park bench, and someone looks at you cross-eyed, and you think you're afraid, and so you will shoot them. Oh, okay, so that's okay. I just want to if Senator Hoffman would yield for another question, I just have to ask another question.
Senator Chamberlain, were you asking for a point of order here, or? Excuse me. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr.
You
President.
Yield?
I'm going to defer to Senator Chamberlain.
Excuse me. There has not been a question asked by Senator McGuire.
So does Senator Hoffman not yield?
She deferred to Senator Chamberlain.
So Senator Hoffman does not want to, she wants to defer to Senator Chamberlain, so I need to ask my question of Senator Chamberlain, not of Senator Hoffman. Is that what she would like?
Senator Hoffman stated that she would defer to Senator Chamberlain.
So Senator Hoffman does not want to answer any more questions, so she's going to let Senator Chamberlain answer the questions. Okay, so Senator Chamberlain, would Senator Chamberlain yield then?
Senator Chamberlain will yield.
So Senator Chamberlain, so if you were in your house, if you're at a park bench, and is it your understanding, Senator Chamberlain, that if you're sitting at a park bench and you fear for your life because someone walks by and looks at you, that you could shoot them and you would be okay because you were protecting your park bench? And you,
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you. I apologize for the confusion, but I was a little bit enthusiastic here. Senator McGuire, Mr. President, if I was sitting on a park bench and I was legally armed, you got to get a concealed carry to have a weapon, or maybe you have a batter knife. Let's say you got a firearm. And someone walked by me, and they looked at me funny, and or they said, I want to sit there, and I decided to shoot them, I would properly and, of course, spend many years in prison for an unlawful act. I don't think, Mr. President, that some people don't understand. I've read the bill several times. I've read criminal statutes and fairly proficient on the use of force, being in the military, Navy, and the Army, and having taken the law enforcement training classes, although I have not had the privilege of serving in that capacity. And by the way, I do thank all those officers for their work and their dedication. But so I do have some understanding of that process. And nowhere in this bill, Mr. President, members, does it require the citizen to remove all judgment and common sense. All of our laws are filled with that sort of thing. The individual is required to exercise judgment and common sense before they act. And nowhere do I find in this bill that people are no longer required to exercise that judgment or common sense. And this does not expand the use of deadly force, but for a few locations where you're lawfully located, and adding substantial bodily harm to the great bodily harm or death requirement. So specifically, Senator McGuire, if you did that on a park bench, which is fairly silly, you'd be spending decades in prison, as you should. Thank you.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. President. I've heard two now conflicting responses. Senator Hoffman says that wherever you are in the state of Minnesota, you can protect yourself. And Senator Chamberlain has said a few locations. I'm going to ask shortly for Senator Chamberlain to yield and tell me what those few locations are. But would Senator Chamberlain yield for a question? Thank you.
Senator Chamberlain,
could you actually indicate in the bill where it does protect a person? And I'm going to give you a couple of examples and ask where there's protection for a person. And then I'd like actually, if Senator Hoffman would listen to this, I'm going to ask her the same questions. Because this is Senator Hoffman's bill, so I actually would want her to respond on her own bill. But there's a couple of examples. So if you're walking up to a person's house to deliver something or to door knock, you know, sometimes you walk into their porch because a lot of people have porches and you walk in and you door knock. So can you help me understand where in this bill it protects a person who might be door knocking and just very validly there, or a person at a park bench who's sitting there you know, actually maybe, you know, unnecessarily afraid, but they're afraid. It's their own subjective. This is a very subjective bill. It's not really based on anything objective. It's where the person what the person feels. That's the danger in this bill. It actually does take away common sense. It's actually whatever the person feels. So I would just ask you, Senator Chamberlain and Senator Hoffman, to show me in the bill where it protects a person who is just walking by or just going up to someone's door, where it says that they would be protected.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator McGuire. As we mentioned earlier, we could spend years here talking about all the possibilities. But I can say I can tell you what subdivision, Article 3, Subdivision 2, on my short one is page 4, circumstances when authorized, when deadly force is authorized. It clearly lists there when deadly force is authorized. It clearly also states that you have to have judgment and exercise reasonable judgment to determine when you're faced with, you know, substantially bodily harm, great bodily harm, or death. Then you may use it. So again, if someone's knocking on your door and you decide to shoot them or hit them with a bat or stab them, and they have not done any of those things to you, then you're not protected by the presumption that you're protecting yourself from great bodily harm or death. So all these cases, that is the concept that's been around for decades. It's worked, and all they're adding to this is outside your home or on your porch, you don't have to retreat and substantial bodily harm. So, again, I can help you out with that, but it's in the bill right there. Thank you.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Chamberlain, you're right. This issue has been around for a long time, and it's actually worked, so we actually don't need this bill. But the point that you pointed out in the bill is actually doesn't do what you said it does. It absolutely doesn't protect. It doesn't protect someone who's standing at the door, because if that person on the other side reasonably believes they're in harm, they can shoot through. And so it takes away total objectivity. It's a subjective. It could be a person that unfairly believes you're there to get them. And so it takes away all objectivity in this bill. And so if I could ask Senator Hoffman to yield.
Repeat that, Senator.
Would Senator Hoffman please yield for a question?
Senator Hoffman will yield. And again, the nature of our discussion here, yeah. Senators, let us remember to address the President, your comments and your statements. Thank you.
Does Senator Hoffman yield? Oh, thank you.
She will yield.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. The portion of the bill that Senator Chamberlain references actually doesn't do that. So is there any other portion in the bill that would actually protect a person that's, you know, walking by a park bench or walking by a tent in a camping ground or walking on the sidewalk in front of your house? And so could you just please indicate to me in the bill where a person would be protected by that?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. President. I don't even know how to answer that question. Senator McGuire has the bill in front of her. The bill clearly states that if you are not under grave, great, or substantial, the danger of those three incidences of harm, you cannot lawfully go after somebody because they look at you funny. And this bill does not take away the reasonable person standard that's been in case law forever. I mean, it's been decades, hundreds of years. They always will look at what a reasonable person would do. And I would point out that with the conceal and carry permit holders that are throughout the country, there's not been one incident of that kind of stuff happening. And so I think that you could second guess this. You could put all these different instances, what if. And if somebody is going to shoot somebody, this bill is not going to stop them. But what it will do is it won't protect them if they're not in a situation where they are lawfully, where they are in fear of harm or death.
You can't just shoot somebody because they're knocking on your door. That is not stealth, and that's not against the law. And you would be held responsible for that. So while we can continue to do that, to do these little scenarios, the bill does not protect people who do those types of things. The reasonable person standard is still in case law. It's built into this bill, and it's into current statute.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. President. I, with all due respect, Senator Hoffman, if this bill did everything that you said, we might not have so much of a problem with it. But it absolutely does not take away the reasonable person standard. I mean, it really does do all of the things that you said it doesn't do. So you really need to pay attention to, we all need to pay attention to the language in this bill. It expansively defines a dwelling. A dwelling is any place that is, it's a dwelling includes but is not limited to a building or conveyance, and that buildings or conveyance curtilage, which is the sidewalk in front of you, and any attached or adjacent deck, porch, appurtenance, or other structure, whether the building or conveyance is used temporarily or permanently, is mobile, immobile, motor vehicle, watercraft, motorhome, anything. It includes anything that you can think of, and actually, as Senator Hoffman has already said, anywhere you are in the state of Minnesota, you can actually use this deadly force if you believe that you're in danger. But it's just so expansive. And I'm just going to give a couple of examples, and then I'm going to let my colleagues to get up and speak on this. But I will use other states where they do have shoot first. So in Florida, a person, Jason Rosenblum, was shot during an argument with his neighbor about garbage collection. The neighbor was not charged because, of course, they were in their yard. He was in his yard, and he had an disagreement about garbage collection. That's what happens with shoot first in Florida. Shoot first in Texas, Joe Horn fatally shot two men in the back as they left Horn's neighbor's yard. Horn called 911 to report the men as burglars, then decided to go outside and shoot them, citing Texas shoot first laws to the dispatcher. Horn was not charged because they had shoot first. Horn later said he regretted the shooting. I would never advocate anyone doing what I did. We're just not geared for that, he told the media. You know, the dispatcher had said to stay in the house to Horn, you know, when he saw people in his yard, but Horn raced out and shot him in the back. So this is what happens when you have a mentality of shoot first. We have another case in Iowa where some girls, young girls, were in a cemetery with playing ghost stories, and they happened to walk up the sidewalk of the nearby house because it was a haunted house, it was a spooky house, they called it, and they only walked halfway up the sidewalk, and then they got scared by the horn honking, so they raced back to their car. As they were leaving in their car, the owner of the home pulled out his shotgun and shot into the girls and critically injured one of the girls. And he says, I was just protecting my home as the girls were, you know, driving away. And so this is a man, he was charged because they didn't have shoot first. But he wouldn't be charged if they had shoot first. It's a mentality of indiscriminate use of deadly force. I mean, we've actually heard the authors say that. This is use of deadly force anywhere that you want it to be. So I ask members to actually read the bill and know what it actually says and what it stands for. And our laws in Minnesota are keeping our citizens safe. There's been no indication that we actually need this bill, and I urge members to vote no.
I have Senator Latz next on the list. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam President and members. Senator Hoffman indicated in her remarks that do we really want to have a state where only cops are allowed to carry guns? I wonder if Senator Hoffman would identify where in statute it says that now and how this bill would change that.
Senator Hoffman.
Madam President, could Senator Latz repeat his question? I didn't understand him, literally didn't understand what he said.
Senator Latz.
Madam President, Senator Hoffman, in her earlier remarks, queried the body whether we really want to have a state in which only cops can carry guns. Presumably she was making that as an argument in favor of this bill. So I'd like to know if Senator Hoffman can point out where in Minnesota law it says that, but for this bill, only cops would be able to carry guns.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Latz, I was responding to some remarks that Senator Harrington had made. I didn't say that it was in the bill. I was responding to his remarks that he said the chiefs and the sheriffs and everybody should be the ones that determine what these bills come through. And I will tell you that there's a whole lot of people out here who believe in the Second Amendment, and that was my response to what Senator Harrington was commenting on. I never claimed that it was in the bill.
Senator Latz.
Well, Madam President, I would respectfully submit that Minnesota law does allow, and the Second Amendment does allow, people to carry guns, and this bill has absolutely nothing to do with that. Madam President, Senator Hoffman stated in her remarks that current law already protects us in our home. In fact, she repeated that several times. I wonder if Senator Hoffman could explain why then we need to change the law as this bill does.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. As I've stated before, most violent crime occurs outside the home. And if you are someplace lawfully, and I've said this multiple times today, if you are someplace lawfully and somebody threatens you with grave, great, or substantial bodily harm, you should have the right to defend yourself. And that's what this bill allows. This bill is about what happens after the fact. You can't make those determinations. And the bill does, in law and in the bill, it talks about a reasonable standard. And so if this would ever happen, it would be up to the police and the county attorneys and the courts to determine if they were in their rightful place at their rightful time doing what they could do to defend themselves. This bill is not about any other than that, but to protect the law-abiding citizen from protecting themselves.
Senator Latz.
Madam President, I asked Senator Hoffman about the changes in the bill to the law relating to protection of the home. I didn't ask about anything outside of the home. I wonder if Senator Hoffman could explain if, as she already stated, the current law protects us in her home, why does this bill before us make changes to the use of deadly force applicable in the individual's home?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. I'll repeat myself again. Current law protects us in our home. We are a castle doctrine state. I will repeat myself again. It's outside of our home that we are unprotected. We have the duty to retreat in Minnesota, and we're trying to change that because a lawful citizen in a lawful place should not have to retreat if a violent criminal is threatening them, and that's what this bill will change.
Senator Latz.
Madam President, apparently, Senator Hoffman doesn't know the content of her own bill. Today in Minnesota, a person may use deadly force without an obligation to retreat if this is done to prevent the commission of a felony in their home. That's already current law, at least according to County Attorney James Backstrom from Dakota County. What I don't understand is why on line 5.1 of the bill, the law is proposed to be changed. Apparently, Senator Hoffman is not able to give an explanation as to why we need to change that law. Madam President, Senator Hoffman also stated that the duty to retreat does not protect victims. I wonder if Senator Hoffman could explain to the body what the duty to retreat is that she proposes to change with her bill.
Senator Hoffman, will you yield? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. If I understand Senator Latz's question, he's asking me what duty to retreat is. Did I understand that? Did I miss something?
That is correct, Senator Hoffman.
Duty to retreat is if you are in a situation, you have to take that split-second determination if you can run away or if you can defend yourself. And I think I used a really great example of somebody my age or any woman who would be in a situation where maybe the aggressor is in your yard, and yeah, maybe you could get in your house, but what if you can't? And I'm not willing to allow a violent criminal to prevent me from being out in my yard and having to think I've got to run in my house and protect myself. And so duty to retreat in this state means if you can get away safely, you should do that. But how do you determine that? Like I said, if a criminal has a knife and they're 21 feet away from you, before you can draw your gun, they will be on top of you. So how do you determine when that duty to retreat is? And that reasonable standard has to apply, and the courts will look at that, and that is their job.
Senator Latz.
Well, Madam President, it sounds like Senator Hoffman or proponents of this bill would prefer that we not have a duty to retreat at all, but she defines the duty to retreat completely out of existence, even though it does exist in current law. Members, a duty to retreat is if you can safely and reasonably retreat in a manner that would avoid the harm that you think you're facing. If you can't, under current law, you have a right to use enough force to prevent that harm. But if you can safely retreat to avoid the harm that you are facing, you have a duty to make that retreat, rather than shooting someone else dead. That's current law. It appears that Senator Hoffman doesn't understand current law that she's attempting to change. Because members...
Madam President, point of order.
Senator Ortman, state your point of order.
I think there are rules of decorum about making personal attacks against senators.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. I would remind all of the senators to please maintain that decorum and refrain from personal attacks. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam President. What current law does, members, is it refuses to make victims out of those who do not need to be victims of capital punishment. It makes a moral judgment. Current law makes a moral judgment between levels of harm and what the appropriate punishment ought to be. It says that if someone is trying to take your wallet, that doesn't mean that they deserve to be killed. If someone is trying to throw paint on you, they do not deserve to be killed. If someone is trying to take a $1,000 TV, and I use $1,000 intentionally because that's the threshold for felony theft as opposed to gross misdemeanor theft, our current law says they do not deserve to die because they want to take a stereo that's worth $1,000 or more. But this bill in front of us would allow someone to kill another person because they were about to lose their $1,000 value stereo. And I ask you if that is the kind of moral judgment that we want to have in the state of Minnesota. Members, I have reviewed the article that Senator Hoffman had distributed about the situation in Des Moines. I took a look at that she says advocates for the bill that we have in front of us. She specifically said on the floor here today that in this situation, Mr. Lewis, the person who was arrested, lost his life. That was the term she used, that he lost his life. Members, I was astounded because this talks about Mr. Lewis being released from jail back out into the community after he was acquitted of the offense for which he was charged. Now, it's not to minimize the hardship he went through. He did lose his job and he lost the place he was living. And in fact, he got his job back. But he had shot another person. He had killed another person. And he was, when he was facing
substantial physical danger. And in fact, the jury evaluated the situation, as they should have, and concluded that Mr. Lewis should not be put in prison for murder, that in fact he was exercising his right to self-defense. So the law worked in the case in Des Moines. The law worked as Minnesota's law is currently written. We don't need to change our law. It was not a situation where the law is different in Iowa than in Minnesota. This example is an example for current law, not to change the law, members. Remember, Senator Hoffman said that the case in which a person was bludgeoned to death cries out for this change in the law. Will Senator Hoffman yield to a question?
Senator Hoffman will yield. Senator Latz.
Senator Hoffman, would you please explain what is it about current law that would not have protected the victims in that example that you used?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. First of all, let me clarify what I said. What I said was that you can use anything as a weapon, as a lethal weapon. And in this situation, the case that Senator Latz is speaking of, the man was bludgeoned to death. And that's all I was making the point in that article, is that anything can be used as a dangerous weapon. This isn't just about guns. This is about defense.
Senator Latz.
Members, I think we can take what in the law we would call judicial notice of the fact that there are weapons that can cause death other than firearms. That doesn't speak for or against the change in the law that's in the bill in front of us. But in fact, in that case, had the victims of being bludgeoned to death had available to them weapons to protect them, a gun, for example, they could have, under current law, used that gun to protect themselves against the home invasion they were facing, against the threat, as it turned out, to their life that they were facing. Current law more than adequately protects people in Minnesota in that situation. So we should not be alarmist enough here to suggest that current law is not protecting people in their homes today. It protects them so well that there have not been any instances of prosecution, any instances any of the proponents can cite, where current law does not protect them. Members, Senator Hoffman also stated that the reasonable person standard is not being changed in this bill. Well, members, I beg to differ. I read line 5.5 and 5.6 of the bill to exactly change today's reasonable person standard, because today's reasonable person standard is an objective standard. It holds up a mythical reasonable person, an objective reasonable person. What would you, me, a jury, a judge, a prosecutor, when looking at all the facts and circumstances, consider to be a reasonable person's response to whatever was being faced? That standard is explicitly changed in this bill. It is flat out an erroneous statement of law to suggest otherwise. Don't believe me for that. Believe the County Attorneys Association, the people whose job it is to interpret and enforce exactly that law. And in their statement that you have on your desks, and in the statement from County Attorney Backstrom that you have on your desks, it states exactly that. Because lines 5.5 and 5.6 refer to what the individual reasonably believes is the commission or imminent commission of a forcible felony. The individual that is using the force in their own mind, members, in their own mind, no matter how demented it might be, no matter how unreasonably fearful it may be to the usual person, no matter how skittish they may be, if they are in their tent in a state park and someone else goes to the bathroom at 2 o'clock in the morning and they're wandering back to their own tent, and oh, by mistake, they cut off on the wrong path and they make noise outside of a person's tent, and that person is scared. Under this bill, that person could shoot through the tent. With the expansion of dwelling, they could shoot through that tent to protect themselves against what they perceive to be that threat. It may be no threat whatsoever. It may be your 13-year-old child trying to get back to your tent, who got a little bit lost coming back from the bathroom in the dead of night in a state park. What would you say then? Should the occupant of the tent that chose to fire at the perceived intruder had a duty, maybe, to look outside the tent before firing? To see if it was a wayward 13-year-old girl instead of a robber or a person coming in attempting to kill them? What would you say at the funeral of your 13-year-old daughter if they're the victim of the standards that are in the bill before us here today? Now, members, this is a bill that's not only about the so-called castle doctrine, or what I term and others term the shoot first bill, because in fact you do, and especially under the example I gave you, and you can pick any location you want, as has been said here, any location you want in Minnesota, because now you have the right to shoot first and ask questions later if this bill passes, to figure out the situation later if this bill passes. Later may have no meaning whatsoever if you're a good aim. But there's more to this bill than just this shoot first component. I want to note, ironically and somewhat parenthetically, that there's a provision in this bill that provides for plaintiff's lawyers to get attorney's fees if they are successful in prevailing to enforce Article 2 of this bill. Article 2 of this bill provides for the authority, or redefines, I should say, the authority to seize and confiscate firearms. And I would ask if Senator Hoffman would yield and explain exactly what the change in the law is that Article 2 provides for.
Senator Hoffman, will you yield? Senator Hoffman.
Madam President, could you have Senator Latz repeat the question, please?
Senator Latz.
I would ask if Senator Hoffman would explain the change in law that Article 2 of her bill does.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. As I explained at the beginning of the bill, this would put into law when the government would have authority to seize or confiscate firearms. And this section only applies during the effective period of a state of emergency as declared by the governor. This was prompted by what happened during Katrina, when law enforcement confiscated guns and weapons, so people didn't have the right to defend themselves. I don't know how much more clear that part of the bill can be for Senator Latz.
Senator Latz.
So, Madam President, other than describing that this part of the bill applies during a state of emergency, I'd ask again if Senator Hoffman would explain what is the change to the law that will apply during the state of emergency.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. The change in the law is exactly as stated in the bill.
Senator Latz.
Well then, members, let me explain it to you. What this bill says, I refer you to lines 2.16 to 2.22 of the bill. During a state of emergency proclaimed by the governor, whether or not a police officer's activity is even related to that state of emergency, doesn't matter. A police officer who disarms an armed individual, if they don't arrest that person, or they don't seize the firearm or deadly weapon for evidence, they have to give that weapon right back to that individual as soon as they leave the location. So if someone has a gun in the house and the police are responding to a domestic call, and this could happen in any community in Minnesota, happens every night. Who are the first responders on domestic calls? They get the 911 call. Someone saying, my husband is getting really, really angry at me and looks like he's going to hit me. I need some help. And the police get there within 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. And they get in there and they see there's a gun on the table. And wife is screaming at husband and husband is screaming at wife. And the officer says, you know what, it's probably not a good idea to have a loaded gun sitting on the end table right here while this is going on. So the police officer takes the pistol. And let's assume for purposes of argument that it's a lawfully retained pistol, that there's nothing illegal about the pistol being at that location. I can tell you what officers have told me is that it would be their practice to retain possession of that firearm, even if they make no arrest. And they might take it back to the police department and hold it overnight and let people cool off a little bit. This bill would make that illegal, and it would subject our law enforcement agencies to a lawsuit to enforce it and make them pay if they lose. Attorney's fees if they lose. Would you rather have the police officer say, okay, you're not yelling above 110 decibels anymore, and you're not yelling above 110 decibels anymore, and yeah, you're really red in the face and I can see the blood pumping through you, but I think I'm not going to make any arrests here because I just don't have enough evidence to do that. And I don't see any evidence that this gun was used in commission of any offense, so it's not evidence in anything. I can't take it with me, says Mr. Police Officer. Under the law, if this bill passes, officer has to put the gun back down on the end table and walk out the door. Would we all be surprised if 15 seconds later a gunshot might be heard from inside the house? How dare you call the cops, says irate husband. Now look what you've done. And he waves the gun about, threatening his wife. Very, very angry, and the blood still pumping through his veins. Oops, maybe a little bit too much pressure on the trigger. Now a threat, how dare you, has become a murder. But for this bill that we have before us, is that really what you want? To make lawful, no, not only make lawful, require in Minnesota, prohibit the police officer from making the situation calmer, allowing time to pass for parties to cool off before putting a deadly weapon back in their hands. That's what Article 2 does. I'm certainly not voting to put every potential victim of domestic violence at risk of death because we have handcuffed the police officer's hands behind his back from defusing a dangerous situation. Members, if you vote for this bill, you are voting to place every potential victim of domestic violence at risk of death.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. I'm going to ask that we not engage in some a little bit of rhetoric here. I will read section line 2.14 and 2.15. This section applies only during the effective period of a state of emergency proclaimed by the governor relating to a public disorder or disaster. That's all this section, this article refers to. And Madam President, I move that we lay this bill on the table.
Senator Hoffman has moved to lay House File 1468 on the table. That's non-debatable. All in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, members, I'd now move that we do a recess until 4:30. We'll come back and take this bill up again and hopefully bring it to conclusion. Thank you.
And just as a note, I do have a list, and we will pick up from where I left off with the list, just so that everybody's aware that has been on the list. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Members of the Judiciary Committee, we normally start at 1 o'clock. We will be starting at 1:30, 10 minutes from now. I hope you all can get down there to establish quorum quickly.
Senator Gimsey.
Madam President, members of the Transportation Committee, we will also be starting at 1:30. We have four bills that we want to work our way through and would appreciate your prompt attendance. Thanks.
Senator Senjum renews his... Oh, Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Agriculture Rural Economies Committee is not meeting at a regularly scheduled time today. We are having a joint hearing with Energy Committee and at 3 o'clock. So thank you, Madam President.
Senator Senjum renews his motion. We recess until 4:30. All in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. We are in recess.
That further proceedings under the roll call be dispensed with and the Sergeant of Arms be instructed to bring in the absent members.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, I move that House File 1467 be taken from the table.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. I would like to clear something up from earlier today. If everybody could look under their desks, we're working off the unofficial engrossment. I think there was some confusion earlier. The second engrossment that was handed out is the wrong version of the bill. Please look under your desks and find the right version.
And we will continue. I did have a list from the earlier session, so we will continue with that. Senator Marty?
Thank you, Madam President. On this bill, Senator Hoffman, I know that you were asked by both Senator Harrington and Senator McGuire to give even a single example of somebody who was prosecuted in Minnesota, convicted of shooting someone in what might have been termed self-defense, and you didn't come up with even a single example of why we would need this. You did come up with an article from the Des Moines Register, which when I read the article, I was trying to figure out how that related to it because the guy was acquitted of shooting and killing somebody in a case where he was clearly self-defense. And if this law existed in Iowa at the time, this guy would have had another defense, but he didn't need one. He was already acquitted. As you pointed out, there's not been a single case in Minnesota where somebody has been prosecuted for shooting somebody in self-defense. But I think what's troubling about the bill is you're portraying it as giving an innocent person a right to self-defense. And the reality is your bill isn't giving an innocent person anything. It's giving everyone who's got a gun a different presumption and clearly an additional defense in court. The reality is the same presumption applies not just to you defending your castle. The same depend goes to the gang member who shoots somebody else and I thought they were coming after me. The same presumption goes to the drug dealer. It goes to anybody. They have another defense. And Senator Hoffman, earlier today you mentioned that it was a question of whether we were going to side with the victim or the criminal, and you said it was time to side with the victim. And again, this isn't siding with either side. What this is giving a defense, one more defense to the person doing the shooting, whether they're the good guy or the criminal. And I think what was really helpful is former Chief Harrington giving us two examples, David Mack, who I think a lot of us remember, he was the police officer in Minneapolis, 1979. In a drug bust, they announced they were cops. He was shot. He was in a coma for 2 years. They didn't think he'd come back, but he did come back. He lived a total of 7 years afterwards. And in that case, they couldn't prosecute him even under our current law. So maybe this law wouldn't hurt anymore in that case because they couldn't prosecute him already because you couldn't show beyond a reasonable doubt that he had legitimate fears that the person, the cops who were coming in on him, weren't criminals. But the other story that Senator Harrington talked about earlier, can't see who put it out, it's a letter to Roger Reinert from the St. Louis County Attorney's Office about a Sergeant Wilson in Duluth, another case where an officer was killed going to the door. In this case, he shot it through the door. The only way he knew somebody out there was there was an announcement that there are police officers out there. And in this case, the current defense wasn't enough for him because no reasonable person would shoot through the door when they say there are police on the other side. But if this bill passes, he would have another defense. So Senator Hoffman, your bill won't protect any innocent people. What it does is give whoever is doing the shooting one more defense in their crime. If it's a crime, and if it's not a crime, they get an extra defense too. But clearly, there are none of those people who haven't committed crimes who are being convicted anyway. You couldn't give a single example. So I want to just make two other points quickly. One of which is, you know, we're not talking just about the home and the real scenarios by which these things happen when people make rash decisions and they think they've got the right to shoot first. And probably a realistic example is somebody who's driving their car and they perhaps inadvertently cut somebody off on the road. Next stoplight, somebody comes up and taps on their window. If you're like me, you'd probably be afraid it might be somebody with road rage who's mad at you. You might have legitimate fear they're going to punch you, hit you, do something to you. You'd have potential fear under the current law. What you'd be expected to do as a reasonable person is drive away. But under this law, you don't have to do that. You can just blow the person away with your gun. And it doesn't matter if it was a potential road rage case or somebody who's trying to tap on your window to tell you your rear lights are out. You shoot first and ask questions later. The bottom line is this doesn't tilt anything in favor of the victim or tilt anything away from the criminal. All it does is give one more defense that the innocent people don't need and the criminals will get. And maybe it wouldn't have mattered in Officer Mack's case, but Officer Warren in Duluth, it would make the difference because they did convict that guy of murder. And with this bill, they probably wouldn't be able to. I think this bill is tragic to see it happen. I don't think it's going to be hundreds and hundreds of cases of people being gunned down because of it. Those two examples of police officers were 1979 and 1990. It's not an everyday occurrence. But in both cases, it was the drug dealers, it was the bad guys who get off. They're the ones who get the other defense that they don't really need. And I frankly think that this is a true public safety issue. I think that's why so much of our law enforcement community has been so outspoken on it. I urge members to reject this. This isn't criminals versus victims. This is an extra defense that the criminals shouldn't have and the others don't need.
Before we continue the debate, I'm just going to have the secretary give House File 1467 its third reading.
House File Number 1467, a bill for an act relating to firearms, clarifying and delimiting the authority of public officials to disarm individuals at any time, third reading.
Senator Cruz, you were next on the list.
Thank you, Madam President and members. I rise in support of this legislation. As many things that we debate in this body, good people, intellectual people can disagree on any given issue, and I think this particular issue is no different. I, in particular, come from a city in Brooklyn Park that has fought extremely hard over the past 10 years to bring down its crime rate. And phenomenal job by the mayor out there and the city staff, the police force. We now have our crime rate down to a 20-year low. Absolutely phenomenal. I have a police chief, my police chief in Champlin, which I also represent, and I have had multiple conversations on this, Chief Kolb. Good people can disagree. He has concerns about this legislation, and we've talked about this legislation. He's challenged me to look at the statute and interpret the statute, and I've done that. And he and I have come to, a difference of opinion on this. Good people can disagree. I'm hopeful that we will find bipartisan support for this legislation before the day is done here. We've talked a lot about respect for our police force, and I think you'll be hard-pressed to find anybody that's more respectful of our police force than I am. I carry them in the highest regard. I truly appreciated Senator Harrington's comments as well. But I want you to know that as I've spoken to people in my district, police officers in my district about this legislation, there are police officers who feel differently. I'd like to share with you an email that I received from one of my Metro Police lieutenants out of Coon Rapids. And I'm not going to mention his name, but I'd like to just read you a portion of this email that I received. I'm a Metro Area Police Lieutenant. I received an email that was generated from various sources, MPPOA, Chiefs Association, Sheriff's Association. I believe it was from the Minnesota Law Enforcement Coalition. I disagree completely with their position on this topic, as do many of my colleagues. Their examples were only hypothetical. No actual events where a law like this worked in favor of a bad guy. Bottom line, please push forward with these bills. They're good for the citizens of this state. Thanks. We've heard a lot of hypothetical stories as we've debated this bill, and I guess, good or bad, I'd like to participate in that and tell a story of my own. Imagine with me, you're young, 18-year-old mother. Okay? It's New Year's Eve. On Christmas Day, you lost your young husband to cancer. You're sitting at home. The only thing you have left of him is the 3-month-old child in your arms. Rap, rap, rap on the door. The door bursts down. 2 intruders. You see a knife. You grab your child, and you quickly run upstairs and get to a phone, locking the door behind you. You spend 20 minutes. You have a shotgun. You have a shotgun in the bedroom, and you've grabbed it at this point. Okay? You're on hold, 911, talking to the operator, asking them, do I have permission to shoot? You don't know. Finally, 20 minutes goes by.
They're at the door to your bedroom now. Now they've found where you are. Baby's crying, and they're coming in after you. The operator, after 20 minutes, police still are not there, finally says, you do what you have to do to protect your baby. As that happens, the door bursts open, and in come two intruders, one with a knife coming directly at you. You shoot and kill that intruder. The other one flees. Members, that's not a hypothetical story. That happened. It didn't happen here in Minnesota, but it happened in Oklahoma. True story. Certain members have constantly asked, what is the reason for this legislation? That, members, is the reason for this legislation. I don't ever want to have that 18-year-old young mother have to think twice about defending herself. She knew she was in imminent danger a long time before she pulled the trigger. She waited for police. They were going to be too late. She still didn't know if she could pull the trigger. We need to embrace our Second Amendment rights. We need to become more familiar with them. I've been around for a little while. I had the pleasure of serving as a session-only legislative assistant in the House of Representatives when we were debating concealed carry. And I got to watch a lot of that debate. What I remember of that debate is all of the gory stories that were told that never happened. There were going to be bodies in the Target Center. The streets were going to flow red with blood. It hasn't happened. As a matter of fact, and I'm hoping my friends from Minneapolis and St. Paul can back me up on this, crime, murder, has gone down. The bottom line is, when you are talking about firearm legislation, the only people who obey the laws that we pass are law-abiding citizens. The criminals don't care. They're going to do whatever they want to do anyway. So you're only handicapping those who are going to use weapons responsibly. That's what I believe. We should think about that. So I hope we can find bipartisan support for this legislation and pass it out today. I think it's a good bill. I think we should pass more legislation like it. I think we should become more familiar with our Second Amendment rights. And I hope you'll vote green.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam President. We've heard a lot of hypotheticals here today. But members, I'd like to give you my own personal story. How this change in law could have affected me. It was a weeknight. I was in my home. My children were in bed. My wife and I were late night owls. Those of you that work around the Capitol often will notice that my car is the last one in the parking lot out on Aurora. That's a similar schedule we keep at home. My wife and I were at home. It was somewhere near midnight, and my wife wanted literally a midnight snack. And I said, why don't you go out? We have a detached building, a garage. So why don't you get something out of the freezer and bring it in? And she said, no, I'm too scared. I just don't feel comfortable. And I scoffed. I said, what are you worried about? We live in town. What do you think, there's a burglar out there? And she wouldn't go. So I said, okay, fine, I'll come along with you. We walked out, turned on the lights outside. She went over to open the door. Somebody, my kids or somebody, had left the hose out on the yard. I stepped away to reel up that hose. And as my back was turned, I heard a scream and a yell, and I turned around, and my wife was falling into the yard. And I quickly ran a couple of steps over to see what was going on, as a thousand scenarios were running through my mind. And I stepped up to the doorway, looked inside, and out of the shadows behind the door stepped a man and took a step forward. Now, members, I wasn't in my home. Depending on your definition, I was in my driveway or a walkway. My wife is laying in the grass on her back, and I have a criminal staring me in the face. And I can tell you, I did not for a second think, what does the law tell me to do right here? Not for a second did that pass through my mind. I instinctively took a defensive position. I looked the man in the eye, and I tell you, I remember the words today. I said, I will kill you. Because there was no way that criminal was going to get a shot at harming my wife. For all I know, who had a broken leg? I don't know. Now, thank God that criminal had the sense to back down. And I didn't have to forcibly take action. But I would have. And if I had, the law said, I first had an obligation to retreat. My wife first had an obligation to retreat. Now, scenarios like that, regular, everyday people who are faced with criminals, and right now the responsibility is on the everyday person to suddenly remember the law, if they've even read it or heard about it. Think about the scenario. Think about maybe 1,000 variables that are involved in their specific circumstances. They're standing in the yard or in the driveway or whatever. The onus is on the regular, everyday, law-abiding citizen and not the criminal. Now, in my situation, the onus should have been on the criminal, not on me. And that's backwards, and that's wrong, and we need to fix it.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Excuse me, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senator Harrington has remarks to that point.
Under the both of the scenarios that were just sketched out, Minnesota Statute 609.06 clearly is in play. There is no new need for a new law for this. In both cases that they just sketched out, they would have been absolutely justified under current law in using force to defend themselves, and there is no requirement for retreat when you are under attack. So there just isn't. So to that point, while they both have great stories, and I can certainly sympathize and empathize with both of those stories, they're factually not accurate as a point of law.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Cruz wants to respond to that. Senator Cruz.
Madam President, just very quickly to that point, I want to reiterate, I wasn't saying in my story that she couldn't have done that here in Minnesota. The point of me telling that story was that she had to think about it. She had to think whether she could defend herself. The operator who was handling the 911 call had to think whether she could defend herself. That was the point of telling that story. I'd never said that she couldn't defend herself under current statute.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam President. And I'm going to first start out by addressing Senator Harrington's comments about the law does cover that particular instance with Senator Ninon's situation. But I'll give you another situation, and I think we can all remember this situation where a daughter and a mother and a father were having in an eastern state dinner. I believe it was dinner in a restaurant, and a gunman came in and started shooting up the place, and ended up actually killing this daughter's mother and dad, and out in the car, because the law required it in this particular state, out in the car was her handgun she was not able to carry. Not able to carry into that restaurant to protect herself. Put yourself in that position, folks. That's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about so terribly much about home invasion. We're making an awful lot about home invasion here. We've come up with a lot of hypotheticals, and Senator Harrington and I can sit here and give you hypotheticals for 5 days, probably, of different things and different tragedies. Senator Hoffman, I think, passed out the most recent tragedy here in Blue Earth County. Yes, that person could have protected himself if they'd had a gun. I'm here to tell you, folks, there's a lot of folks in the state of Minnesota that don't even realize to this day that they can actually protect themselves even in their own home. They just don't. Because there's an awful lot of noise being made about how dangerous these guns are in the hands of criminals. That's exactly how we should stay focused, folks. We should stay focused on criminals. A lot of things have been said here, and there's a lot of emotion with this, and I understand that. Some of the things are being said like more killing of people. Really? Shoot first. I don't think so. Funerals of 13-year-olds, 13-year-olds who were killed running through the state park. I mean, we can talk about terrible tragedies. We can make up all kinds of tragedies that could scare everybody. But there are some real facts we should be talking about here. We should be talking about the national crime statistic that will show you that 75% of the major crime in this country, not only in Minnesota, but in this country, is out of the home. Maybe we should consider that. Maybe we should consider that, folks. There's some terrible things going on. Senator Harrington knows very well, and I'm sure there's an awful lot of folks that do, that this meth situation, this drug situation in this country is clearly, not an epidemic by any stretch, I suppose, but nevertheless, these people are different than the ones that he and I grew up as rookies dealing with drunks and somebody that was smoking a little bit of marijuana. We knew how to handle those people. You could look at those people. You could tell exactly what they were going to do. You could react to them. And you didn't necessarily have to tase them. You can most generally talk them out of things. Now you've got folks that are coming at you that are fearful. They're very fearful. They look right through you. That's the folks that we're dealing with out here. That's the folks we're talking about. There were some folks talking earlier about the County Attorneys Association. I find it quite interesting. They're not supporting this. Actually, I've signed a bill this year, and I'm sure you probably have heard this. I've signed a bill because of what initiated up in the northeast part of our state, where the county prosecutor was injured while performing his duties. The particular bill that I have now is going to allow county attorneys to protect themselves. They're going to be able to carry a handgun, if they so choose, after the training, to be able to protect themselves. I find it a little bit ironic that they're not willing, not quite willing, to allow the folks that actually voted them into office, that voted you and I into office, and also that voted the sheriff into office, the same opportunity to protect themselves. Now, I certainly understand why. I wouldn't have signed on to that bill. That's a dangerous, dangerous job. They're finding out there's becoming more assaults, and it's exactly by the people I'm talking about. You just can't predict what they're going to do. But I find it funny that they don't support this bill for the very people that elected them. Just a comment. Also, the chiefs and sheriffs. Chiefs and sheriffs are some of my best friends. And Senator Harrington has got an awful lot of friends in this profession as well. We understand the job. We know the job. We sometimes on the floor here convey what they actually come up to and what they come across and what split-second decisions they've got to make. What can take attorneys and courts years, literally years, to interpret. They have to be able to do. They have to be able to react in a moment's notice, not only to protect the public, but to protect themselves. Handgun permits were an issue some years ago. And when I took over sheriff in 1990, over the next ensuing 16 years, I basically handed out, for those that were able to qualify, many handgun permits to carry in the public. Not once in those 16 years did I have one of those permittees commit a crime. The reason I mention that is sheriffs and chiefs back then, and I don't know about the county attorneys or the prosecutors back then, were basically saying some of the similar things that they're saying now. This is going to be the wild, wild west. We're going to have guns on everybody. They're going to be shooting the place up. It's going to be a very unsafe place to happen. 90,000 people the first year are going to have permits. Folks, there wasn't, I don't think, even 12,000 the first 2 years. And I don't think the 90,000 numbers even hit to this day. Statistically, in states where this Castle Doctrine has been passed, similar legislation, statistically, doesn't even show up the amount, the number of incidents where people who are legally carrying guns to protect themselves, the citizens, the very citizens that we work for, that pay the bills,
doesn't even show up. It's 0.00019% incident rate. Who are we talking about? Who are we spending time talking about today? We're talking about, I think, giving the criminals free run. And you know, folks, that we got to knock that off. We got to stop that attitude. We got to start talking about the people who are being victimized, who have an opportunity now under this legislation to be able to protect themselves, if they so choose. And yes, they aren't going to just shoot it up. I have a lot more faith in the people that put me in this office, folks. I really do. I don't think they're just going to take a gun out and shoot because they have somebody as it gets approached on a park bench, or if I hear somebody running through the county park or the state park, and I'm going to shoot at somebody like that. That's not a responsible citizen in Minnesota. That's not anybody that I'm working for. It's just not going to happen. These are all hypotheticals that I'm not sure where they're taken from. I want to get back a little bit about the chiefs and the sheriffs and the difference. I've got a lot of friends that are chiefs, worked closely with chiefs. I'm going to throw a number out. Senator Harrington can help me, but I think there's about 450-some chiefs in the state of Minnesota. Somewhere is there, probably upwards of that. And, of course, there's 87 sheriffs. There is a difference. There is a real difference between the statutory authority of sheriffs and chiefs. At one time, former chief can tell you, that handguns were issued by the chief. And that was somewhat of a bone of contention with the folks that were going after permits. And I'm only going to speak with my experience with the chief I had. And he's a dear friend of mine. We worked closely together, and we're dear friends to this day, and will always be. And we both retired at similar time, about 6 years ago. He didn't issue as many permits as I did. And he had that discretion. And I had an awful lot of folks that came through my door and didn't like that. And I said, well, I honored the opportunity for the cities in the state of Minnesota to have chiefs. I was there under their authority. They could appoint their chiefs. I never got into that, never got between that. I never issued a permit for somebody in the city if the chief did not want that. Well, as the history went on here in Minnesota, eventually that was changed to where now it is the sheriff and the sheriff only that issues permits. And I don't think there's a real burning issue with that. I don't think the chiefs are going to stand up and tell you that any of the people that they gave permits to committed crimes. But the bottom line is, the sheriff is different in this way. The sheriff is an elected official. Elected officials respond different to the public. They don't have to answer to only five people. Now, again, I'm going to say that very cautiously with respect to the chiefs. They work for the people that are within their boundaries. But they really do truly answer to five people. At least in rural Minnesota, most city councils are five. The sheriff is responsible for everybody, and I kind of think that's why the law actually ended up going into the sheriff's purview. And that's where it sits today. I don't think the sheriffs are going to come up and tell you that those permittees that are carrying those are committing crimes. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of idea about that, the difference between sheriffs and chiefs. And like them, you and I, we do raise our right hand before we take the oath, and when we're taking the oath, to uphold the Constitution. And that means, folks, that we have to uphold all of the Constitution, not just the First Amendment, which we all know just gets thrown all over the map, but the Second Amendment and the rest of them as well. It's very near and dear to people in this country, and that's the Second Amendment. Again, I can get back into stories. I don't think we have to do that. One of the comments Senator McGuire had made, and it kind of stuck with me a little bit, is that the general public is not geared to shoot people. They just aren't. I'm here to tell you, and I'm not going to speak for Senator Harrington, but in my 35 years, I never had to take anybody's life. I don't know that I'm geared for it either, but it was part of the function that I had that I would have to enact to save either myself or the public. But I'm here to tell you, the people that are out there now running around committing crimes, they are geared to kill you, and they will kill you for little or nothing for their drug habits. And that's what we're seeing. Again, I can go on with stories on and on and on. Most recent story, one of the murders that I had before I retired was a a person that sat in the bar and observed this elderly gentleman with a fanny pack in the front of his belt, and he was buying pull tabs. He was talking about he was buying pull tabs, and he was watching, and obviously this person was observing him, that he apparently had a pretty good stash of money in his belt. Well, I'm sure you know where the story's going. He followed him home, knocked on the door. As he looked in the light, in the side light, and opened the door, as we do, he seen a woman that was standing there with him. He didn't see the guy. The guy maced him in his eyes, knocked him down into the house, and actually stabbed him several times to death. So if, you know, when we talk about home invasion, I can tell you again, we can go to stories on and on and on about home invasions. There is protection in the law for home invasions. We know that. This bill carries that protection out of the home into the street. Folks, before I talk about Section 2, and I know Senator Letts had brought that up with regards to the question of whether the officer is going to go out and confiscate guns during a domestic violence situation in the state of Minnesota, as we know, that hypothetical situation that Senator Letts was talking about, that officer has a discretion of taking that person or one of those people out of the office. In fact, they have to. They have to take one person out if there's domestic abuse under the fifth-degree assault charges. So would they take the gun in a case like that? Certainly they would. Certainly they would. But if there isn't anything there substantial, not enough to charge, yes, they would not be able to take their gun. But what happened in Katrina is they went around and actually rounded up all the guns. Folks, this is not Russia. And I heard that comment many, many times during that terrible, terrible incident, going around rounding up guns. Can you imagine that if you're stranded in your own house, that you are not now going to have the ability to even protect your own property or potentially your life? That's just unheard of. That's a good section. Folks, we gotta stop with this gotcha stuff, these gotcha. This is going to end up killing more people. Shoot first. Talking about funerals for hypothetical of kids that are going to get shot running through the backyards. It's just not going to happen. I applaud Senator Gretchen for carrying this bill. This isn't obviously an easy bill to carry forward, but it's very straightforward. It's one of the constitutional rights that we have as not only Minnesotans, but people who live in the United States under the particular constitution that we have. And it's very sacred, and we should have the right, and we as elected officials should be concerned more about our public safety, the very public that we work for, the public that cares, the public that's doing it right, and allow them the opportunity to protect themselves. So I would encourage everybody to vote for this bill. It's a good bill.
Senator Harrington asked to be recognized to address those specific remarks. Senator Harrington.
To that point, just a couple things. It has been said repeatedly that we are talking in the realm of hypotheticals. Sergeant David Mack, dead, Minneapolis Police Department, not a hypothetical. His assailant found not guilty based on currently existing Castle Doctrine. Gary Wilson, Duluth PD, dead, not a hypothetical. Shot through the door with a .30-06. His assailant found not chargeable based on current Castle Doctrine. Those aren't hypotheticals. Those are two dead cops. I think we can stop with the hypotheticals, and we can start staying with the facts. Couple other facts. While I supported conceal and carry when it came up initially, it is not the panacea that some would say, that nobody has been charged or been found out of line with that. The statistics I've got from the BCA says that since conceal and carry, 110 people with conceal and carry permits have been arrested and charged with domestic violence. 33 people with conceal and carry permits have been charged with sexual assault. Again, 110 charged with domestic violence, 33 charged with sexual assault. Not none. Point of fact, there are people who have had conceal and carry permits who shouldn't have had conceal and carry permits and who have had them taken away for good reasons thus far. Last point to make. There's been a lot of discussion about how this bill protects the Second Amendment. There's nothing in the current law that takes guns away from people. There's nothing in the law that I can tell that is going to curtail conceal and carry. There's nothing in this bill that further extends the Second Amendment rights, nor does it address any of the issues that, with all due respect, my colleague Senator Ingridson made about the folks that couldn't bring their gun into a restaurant or into a place that has properly placarded private property where the owners have decided that they don't want guns inside. Nothing in this bill would have given them permission to violate the wishes of the owner, and nothing in this bill should.
Senator Ingridson.
Thank you, Madam President. And a couple points. The Senator quoted the statistics from the BCA with the domestic violence, and I forget what the other arrest was for. I guess I have to ask him how many of these were perpetrated with a handgun. I didn't hear any statistics on that. Furthermore, the daughter sitting in the restaurant watching her mother and dad be killed by somebody who incidentally walked by that sign that you see in Minnesota, that you see in the bank, no guns allowed in the bank. How foolish are we? How foolish are we? If I'm a bank robber, I come up to the door, I go, wow, that's really kind of handy. Guess what? It's a little better chance that I'm not going to have somebody poke a gun at me when I'm holding up the bank. How foolish is that? The point is, the bad guys are going to carry the guns if they want to carry the guns. They're not supposed to have them. The senator knows that. They're not supposed to have them. But they're going to have them because they're going to steal them. The good people need to have an opportunity to protect themselves. I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be that person that's sitting in that restaurant and watches my mother and dad get killed when my gun is sitting out in the car because there was a sign on the front door saying, I can't come in here with a gun. Thank you.
Senator Harrington.
To that point.
Senator Harrington.
33 women died last year, according to the femicide report. And the most frequent tool used in their execution was a firearm. I can't give him the exact numbers for the entire 110. Happy to look that up and get back to him on that. But I can tell you that in the state of Minnesota in the last year, in cases of domestic violence, which ended in the death of the woman, the most frequent tool was, in fact, a firearm. And I think it's worth noting that. The other piece that I will once again stake again is there is nothing in this bill that speaks to giving new permissions to against private property so that folks that have private property who don't want guns on their property should be precluded from doing that. That's not in this bill, and so I don't know that it's truly germane or relevant to this discussion.
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam President, members. I want to step back for a moment to the final words before we laid the bill on the table at our recess, in which Senator Hoffman reemphasized that the provision denying officers the ability to confiscate weapons applied only in the case of a governor's declared state of emergency. And I had just highlighted the domestic violence situation in which that gun was returned to a home where no arrests were made. It would be cold comfort to the victim of that domestic violence, of that shooting, that the governor had declared a state of emergency. There's no bearing whatsoever. I would also suggest in response to Senator Ingebrigtsen's response to that hypothetical, that it's not really a hypothetical, that there are
are indeed cases where a call goes out for a domestic violence call, but the officers arrive and find that, in fact, there is not adequate grounds to effect an arrest or charge someone with fifth-degree domestic assault. Certainly, it's not the situation that every time there's a phone call alleging something, the officer has a duty to make an arrest. But that's what Senator Ingebrigtsen was suggesting to this body. We depend upon our officers to make investigations when they arrive at a scene and to reach a judgment as to whether or not there appears to be probable cause that a crime was committed. Only then is an arrest lawful. I also find it rather strange that every hypothetical that the proponents of this bill have given to us, hypothetical or actual examples of circumstances, handouts from Des Moines or descriptions of what happened in Oklahoma, or of Senator Ninal's own experience, every one of those situations are currently covered by current law. Current law gave absolutely a full right for persons to defend themselves with use of force, of deadly force, under current state law. There is absolutely nothing that the bill before us would add to make someone more safe under those circumstances. Members, there's been a suggestion that people simply don't realize that they can defend themselves. Really? People don't realize they can defend themselves in their own homes or wherever they are if they're facing great bodily harm or injury or death? I don't believe that, members. To the extent people are questioning their ability to defend themselves now, I think it's a result of debates like this that are suggesting that current law says they don't have that right or ability, when in fact we all know that they do. And debates suggesting otherwise, comments on this floor suggesting otherwise, do a disservice to people's understanding of their current rights to self-defense. And yes, sheriffs are responding to the people that elected them, or county attorneys are responding to the people that elected them. But it's not only people who carry guns and wish to have a right to shoot as soon as someone comes through the door that are electing the county attorneys and the sheriffs. It's everyone else in the districts as well. And in the considered professional judgment of the county attorneys and the sheriffs acting collectively through their associations, this bill would make it more dangerous for the public than current law. And it would make it more dangerous for the law enforcement officers than current law. Members, this bill is also not just limited to legal carriers of weapons, as I understood an earlier suggestion to be, that you know, people who are carrying guns lawfully are going to be properly trained and they're going to make good judgment calls about these things. By the way, nothing in this bill suggests they have to make judgment calls that we would consider good. But the fact is, criminals, people who are not lawfully carrying guns, will be able to use this bill to defend themselves. It will create an enormous loophole for gang members to murder each other on the legal theory that they were facing a threat and they needed to defend themselves. They perceived themselves that they needed to defend themselves. It will make it more difficult, well, not only to prosecute those cases, the bill prohibits even bringing those charges under such circumstances. There's a presumption that applies to present that defense. And members, to the Katrina situation, if the real intent is to address the question of law enforcement just going out randomly and confiscating weapons, then this bill doesn't deal with that. This bill is drafted in a very different way, in a much broader way. If you want to draft a bill that addresses those questions, the question of law enforcement confiscating weapons in a Katrina-like disaster, well, then let's take a look at that on its own merits. But what we have before you is much more broadly written than that. It clearly wasn't in the mind of those who were drafting the bill. They clearly wanted to apply it to a much broader set of circumstances. So members, this bill is just not worth the risk to public safety or to our law enforcement officers to pass, and I encourage a no vote.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam President. I've heard, you know, a lot of discussion about whether or not the examples that are being used are real or hypothetical. Well, I've got one real one for you here. There was an exchange student, Japanese exchange student, 16 years old, that was going to a Halloween, high school Halloween party, and him and his friend ended up at the wrong house, knocked on the door, and then when it wasn't answered, they walked away. Well, the wife inside said, "You better get your gun, honey, and go out there." Well, the teen was not dressed as a vampire or some awful thing. He was dressed as John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever. He had a tuxedo on. The man of the house came out and shot him point blank in the chest, and he died. And the man who did that, I'm sure, was afraid. He was scared. He was a law-abiding citizen. He didn't have any prosecutions against him. But he was cleared, even though the Japanese council made a lot of noise about it, and in fact, it was talked about all over the world as a bad, bad incident of how easily somebody can be mistaken for somebody breaking and entering when all he did was knock on the door. These things happen. And what this bill does is promote vigilante justice. I'm not sure why we're going to need, if this bill passed, why we would need that many police officers anymore, or judges, or prosecutors, or anything else, because people can just take care of their own fears with deadly force. And nothing's going to happen to them as long as they're a law-abiding citizen. And let's talk one more minute about those law-abiding citizens that the NRA likes to talk about so much and how they want to keep guns out of the hands of criminals. Well, that's just not true, folks, because in 2003, they managed to weaken our state law, weaker than any other state in the nation, to say that violent felons can get their gun rights back just by going to any favorable judge in the state. And that's happened. And in fact, in Rice County, there are two cases pending before the judges there on giving rights back to violent felons. And one claims he wants to go goose hunting, and another claims something else. And this is 6 months or so after they got out of prison. So the county attorney is fighting that. But by our law, county attorney doesn't have anything to say about it, really, so they have to fight it on their own and hope it works. This bill passes. You're going to make every citizen that has these civil rights to carry a gun, you're going to make them the judge, the jury, and the executioner. The judge, the jury, and the executioner all at once. Is that what we want for our state? You know, I think more people have high blood pressure and die from it than people who die from home invasions alone, let alone in invasions in their campground or invasions in their boat or invasions in their tent somewhere or on a park bench. This is crazy. This is crazy. This is just unbelievably crazy. This bill, as I said, along with current law that allows violent felons, any crime, violent crime, get their guns back by going to a judge, and that's in Section 609 Let me get this a second here. Here it is. 609.165, which the bill refers to 609, the statute, and says that unless they're allowed to get their, unless they're prohibited under the 609 statute, well, 609 says this, 165, subdivision 1D. It says that a person is prohibited by state law from shipping, transporting, possessing, or receiving a firearm because of a conviction, on and on, for committing a crime of violence. But a person committing a crime of violence may petition a court to restore the person's ability to possess, receive, ship, or transport firearms and otherwise deal with firearms. So, folks, that's what we're looking at here. We're looking at not all these law-abiding citizens that are so under attack by all these scary people, but we're looking at really law-abiding citizens, first of all, that get it wrong. They get it wrong. Somebody wasn't there to threaten them wherever they are. And thankfully, Senator Nuno protected his wife and his property, and he had every right to and would have had every right to shoot him if they didn't. But scaring him away did it. So if he would have just shot him and not tried to scare him away, well, there'd be a dead person, and maybe he was a bad person. I don't know. But that's not our decision to make. That's the police, that's the prosecutors, that's the jury, and that's the judge. That is not our decision to make. And I don't care what rural area you are from, or if you are afraid of the NRA and that's why you'd vote for this bill, think common sense. This is not common sense. Thank you.
Final thoughts, Senator Ortman?
Thank you, Madam President. I appreciate the passion of the members that have debated this bill today and into this evening. I do have a couple of comments. Members, I don't have a gun. I don't have a permit to carry a gun. I would never allow a gun in my house, nor would my husband. I don't think it's a good idea. But I do care very much about your constitutional rights and mine. I care very much that the Constitution says that we have a right to bear arms as citizens and residents of the United States. The Second Amendment clearly says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And there can be all kinds of examples of cases that are brought here, but nothing will convince me that the Second Amendment should be anything but a meaningful right. And that's what this bill is about. It's about protecting a meaningful application of the right to bear arms. Members, you shouldn't look at this as somehow secondary to our First Amendment right of free speech. It should be no less protected as any other right in the Constitution. This takes us right back to the whole premise of our entire government, which is self-government, and the citizens are sovereign. We are the highest office holders in the nation. It's not the president, it's not the governor, it's not state senators, it's we the people, and we have reserved for ourselves the right to bear arms, and this is about making sure it's meaningful. I heard people say that this is legislation in search of a problem. I'm talking about meaningful now. I think that's what this legislation is intended to do, to make sure that that right is meaningful. This bill is not really about what happens in the exchange in the use of force. It's really about what happens in the court of law afterwards. This bill is about creating a presumption that a person can act in self-defense under certain limited circumstances when they defend themselves, when they are legally licensed to carry a gun outside of their home. I heard it said incorrectly that somebody illegally carrying a gun would be entitled to the rebuttable presumption. That is absolutely not correct. They would be entitled to claim self-defense and try and argue it in a court of law, but they would not be entitled to a rebuttable presumption. And that's what we're talking about now. A rebuttable presumption, all that means is that the prosecutor and the chief may have a little bit more work to do to prove that it was not an act of self-defense. And they are certainly capable of doing that in the right cases. I heard an example of Officer Mack, what a terrible tragedy that any law enforcement officer would be injured in the line of duty. Nobody more concerned about that than me, and I don't think anybody here in this chamber would take that lightly. But I did hear in that explanation from Senator Harrington that he believed that the shooter in that case knew or had reason to know that that was a law enforcement officer. That is the amendment that Senator Hoffman adopted today, and that would protect, in this case, the rebuttable presumption from being used in a case like that. Members, we should be able to trust our jurors if there's a question. They can decide whether or not this was a reasonable use of self-defense. The county attorneys will be able to assemble the evidence if it's not. And I think it's fair to ask them to do that. The reason why? Law enforcement should never be threatened, nor should our county attorneys, by a resident's constitutional rights. We balance those rights all the time. And I'm going to give you a few examples from our Constitution, other than the Second Amendment. In the Fourth Amendment, we have a right against unreasonable searches and seizures. Our law enforcement community is perfectly capable of balancing that and following the law. No warrants without a probable cause. That's in our Fourth Amendment. No person shall be held to answer for a capital crime without an indictment or a grand jury. That's in the Fifth Amendment. We also have the fact that you can't be a witness against yourself. You can't be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The government can't take your private property for public use without just compensation. The Sixth Amendment, right to a speedy and public trial, an impartial jury. The list goes on. Excessive bail, excessive fines, no cruel and unusual punishment. Members, we live in this society. We've decided to govern ourselves. We've decided to protect ourselves with individual rights. And the Second Amendment is as important as any other. Members, I hope that you'll vote yes for this bill to say on behalf of the residents that the Second Amendment should have great meaning.
Senator Harrington was on the list, and then Senator Higgins. Senator Harrington.
I realize that the hour is late. I'm going to try and keep this brief. Current Minnesota law, 609.06, says that force can be used when used by any person resisting or aiding another to resist an offense against that person. It doesn't say you got to retreat. It just says you can use force to resist an assault against your person. That's already the law. We don't need another law for that. We've already got one. And it also says that if you're trying to help an innocent on the side, you're also good with that. I heard mentioned earlier today about having to run away if you have not being able to run away if you have someone attacking with a knife. In police work, we call that the Tooler Drill. It's named after a Salt Lake City cop who I trained with, who was trying to figure out how do you defend yourself against a knife. The first thing we taught cops about defending yourself against a knife is to run away. We've got the vest, we've got the shotgun, we've got the pistol, and the first thing we tell the cops in that situation is, run away. So I'm going to tell the public that they shouldn't run away because they have a gun in their purse, but I'm going to tell the cops that the smart play in this is to run as far away as possible and get something really solid between you. The two are irreconcilable in my mind. I've heard a discussion today about this piece about being in a riot or in a public disturbance and that we shouldn't be able to take guns during that circumstance. I've lived through several riots, and I can tell you that in almost every one that I've lived through, the first thing that got hit was the gun store. Are you telling me that once the gun store has been broken into and the guns are being pouring out in the street, you want to prohibit the cops from being able to confiscate those weapons and either return them to safe lock and key? Or are you telling me that, well, because there was a riot in New Orleans or a riot in L.A., that what we should do is watch as the guns pour out into the street to be used on who? On other citizens, in robbing their stores and in further looting? I can tell you the story of Sergeant Pete Panos, one of my colleagues, who in the L.A. riots got shot at as they were trying to stop the looting from a gun store. Finally, my last key point really is as a rebuttal piece. Yes, I get that the juries will do their job, and I get that the courts will do their jobs, but let me read what the statute as proposed actually says. An individual who uses force, including deadly force, according to this section, as otherwise provided by law, in defense of the individual's dwelling, or another individual, is justified in using such force and is immune from criminal prosecution for that act. Immune. You were reasonably using force against somebody else, and you shoot somebody that's standing next to them. You were confronted in the alley. And I passed out an article about a kid that was killed over in North Minneapolis. There was a shootout in the back of that alley. And what happened during that shootout? A baby was killed in a house. Given this law, the shooter in that case, when we find him, and I trust that Minneapolis is going to find him, and Hennepin County is going to find him, would be immune from prosecution if he could lodge a defense of self-defense. Do we really want to give immunity to people who are using guns recklessly? When I was a young cop, and Senator Ingebrigtsen probably can relate to this, you chase people. It's what you do as a young cop. And I'm no chasing people through the yards in the east side of St. Paul at night. I worked the midnight shift over there. When I crossed a fence and I ran through an alley, I knew that at any moment when I came around that corner, the bad guy I was chasing might have a gun or a knife or a club who could try and take me out. It was what I did. It was what we all did who swore that oath to serve and protect. This law will make it such that when I run through that alley now, when that young copper these days crosses that fence, they don't just have to worry about the bad guy. They got to worry about the homeowner who may have him, the officer, in their sights. This is a bill that's dangerous for law enforcement. It will not, repeat, it will not increase the Second Amendment rights for people. It will not reduce violence. It will not make people safer. In fact, I believe that it will make people less safe. And I vote no on this bill.
Final speaker, Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, President, members, we've been in session a month. It's almost 6 o'clock at night. Our residents send us here to deal with jobs. What have we done all day? Talked about loosening our gun laws. We've lost our way. Let's get back to the work that our residents sent us here to do.
Secretary will take the roll on House File 1467. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 40 ayes and 23 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Moving on to 13th order of business, announcements of Senate interest. I have several excuses. Senators Torres Ray and Kielash will be excused all day. Senator Harrington from 11 to 11:30. Senator Limmer from 11 to noon. Senator Sharon from noon to 12:30. Senator Dibble from 11 a.m. to 12:10 p.m. Senator Cohen from 11 a.m. to 12:25 p.m. Senator Higgins from 12:40 to 1:20 p.m. Senator Kubley and Stump from 4:30 until the end of session. Without objection, they are excused. Further announcements of Senate interest. Senator Senjum.
Madam President, I move the Senate do now adjourn until Monday, February 27th. And members, we're going to start at 11 o'clock next Monday, 11 o'clock.
Senator Senjum has moved. We do adjourn until Monday, February 27th at 11 a.m. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. We are adjourned.